Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show improve. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Oratory and argumentation have thousands of years of practice and study under their belts, but today, with seemingly unprecedented levels of distrust between politicians, scientists, social scientists, the press, and the public, and technological advances that are rapidly changing the way we communicate with each other, public language in the West has entered unknown territory. So argues our next guest. Mark Thompson is the president and CEO of the New York Times. He's former director general of the BBC, and he believes public language is in crisis. He has a new book called Enough Said, What's Gone Wrong with the Language of Politics, in which he explains how rhetoric has lost its place as once known as queen of the humanities and makes a case for its return to the throne. Mark, so nice to have you. Welcome to WNYC.
Hi, Brian. Good morning.
So let's be honest. When people use the word rhetoric these days, and maybe for the most part through our lifetimes, they're usually talking about somebody trying to BS them. How are you using the word?
So that's right. So rhetoric, when we think of it, we first of all think it's about talking, and particularly talking in a flowery way. So, you know, giving a wonderful speech. Actually, what the word really means is the art of persuasion. All of the ways that we try and persuade people, which could be a speech, it could be a single word or a phrase. It could be Sarah Palin's death panels or Donald Trump's we've got to build a wall, folks. That's rhetoric. It's trying to persuade people. Some people, the philosopher Martin Heidegger, said that rhetoric is really the art of listening, that actually listening plays at least as big a part in the art of persuasion, of understanding and basing what you say on your understanding of your audience. So rhetoric is a big topic. My basic point, though, is, and I think most people would accept this of left and right, something's gone wrong in the way we're doing this.
What's gone wrong?
Well, I'll give you an instance. The New Yorker reported the other day that Donald Trump had cleared his diary to spend much of a day trying to work out what was the right insult to use about Senator Bob Corker. He concluded that little Bob Corker was old hat. He'd used the word little about Marco Rubio. So he was looking for a new original insult. And so tax reform, Mali, North Korea, global geopolitics, all these distractions are pushed aside. And the leader of the free world spends, it is said by the New Yorker, a long time talking to his friends and supporters about what's the best way of finding a one-word takedown to use on Twitter against a political enemy.
But this isn't just about Trump. Like, you write that in the 80s, while you were at the BBC daily program nationwide, the language of politics, the way you and other journalists sliced and diced that language before presenting it to the public, was already beginning to change.
That's right. And so the compression of the way the media the way we tend to use language, we try and find nuggets and short phrases, which means, of course, politicians start trying to feed that hunger. They, you know, sound bites were originally a description of what TV producers and reporters did, which is clipping short extracts. But quite quickly, of course, the politicians start trying to find the best short encapsulation of something. And it means that the space for language to explain policy, for example, simply gets eroded. And, you know, it favors this kind of compressed language. It favors exaggeration, and it favors the more vituperative, insulting kind of language. And I think over 20 years, we've seen that. And I think Donald Trump is a really good example of this. But I think he's a symptom rather than the cause of the disease.
With your global perspective, do you think this is something common around the world? It's easier to come up with conservative, memorable rhetoric than liberal?
I'm afraid there's probably a slight natural advantage that a rhetoric which is about criticizing things and about arguing that they should be stopped or adjusted is probably easier than making the case for something new.
And you do mention in the book that the rhetoric of the right in this country has changed tremendously over the past three decades. Yeah. Has it changed more than the rhetoric of the left?
Well, I think we can see some pretty dangerous signs in some parts of the rhetoric of the left. I think intolerance of debate about identity politics and about community relations, that the sense you shouldn't listen to racists, you shouldn't ever countenance certain kinds of political argument. I think Hillary Clinton's passage at the LGBT fundraiser last September, when she talked about famously about the basket of deplorables, and she used the word irredeemable about Trump supporters. She said these people are irredeemable. And I think a kind of radicalization of some of the rhetoric of the left, for a progressive politician to describe 20, 30, 40% of the U.S. population as irredeemable is a real radicalization of language. And I'm not quite sure why you're in the business of democratic politics if you think that 40% of your country is irredeemable. Mm.
Context of White Supremacy, Gus T. Renegade, in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Friday, November 3rd, 2017. So I have been told this is our fourth study session on Neil Postman's Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk, How We Defeat Ourselves by the Way We Talk, and What to Do About It. We are closing in on the end of the book. Our last session will be next week. So we are almost done. Hopefully folks have gotten some constructive information. Again, just the importance of paying attention to the way that we use words. I know this is something we talk about on the program a lot. For some people, they may see a value in it, others not. Particularly as it relates to when we start talking about racism, white supremacy, paying attention to the words that are used, how conversations get framed, metaphors that are employed, all very, very important. The sound clip we heard at the beginning, book that just came out not too long ago, Mark Thompson, Enough Said, What's Gone Wrong with the Language of Politics. That interview was from this week, caught my attention, since the book that we're doing with Mr. Postman, where Mark Thompson is talking about some of the same ideas in terms of how we use language, particularly even in the segment that you heard him just talking about. I thought not only him explaining what he means when he says rhetoric, but I thought even the way that he presented his paradigm and saying, well, maybe people on the right are using left in this manner, maybe people on the left are using rhetoric in this manner, or conservatives or liberals, even that way of thinking, using those terms as to how we look at a debate. I think Postman talked about that last week with being dichotomous thinking. Either you're a conservative or a liberal. Either you're a left winger or a right winger. Not we're in the system of racism, white supremacy. Left, right, it's all part of the same white supremacist body. Totally different way of thinking. Without further ado, we will go ahead and get started. We're on the chapter Propaganda. Again, this is Neil Postman, A Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk, Context of White Supremacy, audio segment number one, Outstanding Narration by Mel.
Propaganda. Of all the words we use to talk about talk, propaganda is perhaps the most mischievous. The essential problems its use poses, and never resolves, are reflected in the following definition, given by no less a personage than the late Aldous Huxley. There are two kinds of propaganda. Rational propaganda in favor of action that is consonant with the enlightened self-interest of those who make it and those to whom it is addressed, and non-rational propaganda that is not consonant with anybody's enlightened self-interest, but is dictated by and appeals to passion. This definition is, of course, filled with confusion and even nonsense, both of which are uncharacteristic of Huxley and only go to show how propaganda can bring the best of us down. To begin with, Huxley makes a distinction between good and bad propaganda on the basis of the cause being espoused. If what we are told is good for everybody, then propaganda is rational. If it is bad for everybody, it is non-rational. But how are we to know what is good and what is bad for everybody? In most instances, this is far from self-evident, and not even Aldous Huxley can say for sure what is enlightened and what is not. Moreover, the information we might need to decide the issue is often not available to us. Suppose, for example, a television commercial tells us that a certain drug will help to relieve nagging backaches. That would appear to be in everybody's self-interest, thus rational propaganda. But let us also suppose it is later discovered that in addition to relieving nagging backaches, the drug also relieves you of a healthy liver. Was the commercial good propaganda at the time you heard it, or was it bad? Perhaps it was good when you heard it, but became bad when you learned of the drug's side effects. But since it was never in anybody's self-interest to use the drug, then wasn't the commercial bad propaganda to begin with? And now let us suppose that, in combination with another substance, the drug is rendered harmless to your liver. Will a commercial for the drug, with secret formula Exigy added, now be good propaganda? Then suppose, well, you can begin to see the problems here. But they are simple ones compared to those raised by a television commercial which tells us to vote for a political candidate. How would we know before the candidate is elected if it is in everybody's self-interest to vote for him? Indeed, how would we know a year after his election if it has been in everybody's self-interest? People continually disagree over such matters, and we would be left with a definition of propaganda that says, "What I think has been good for me is rational. What you think has been good for you is non-rational." But Huxley does give us a hint, although a misleading one, of how we may resolve the problem. He says that non-rational propaganda appeals to passion. He says nothing about the type of appeal made by rational propaganda, but we may assume he believes it appeals to the intellect. Here, Huxley has, of course, moved to another ground, and is offering a definition based on the type of appeal, not the goodness or badness of the cause. But, as he has it here, this shift only results in more confusion. What do we say of propaganda that appeals to our passions but in an enlightened cause? And what of propaganda that speaks to our intellect but for a cause that is not consonant with everybody's enlightened self-interest? There are two possible ways out of this dilemma, as far as I can see. The first is to stop using the word propaganda altogether. Huxley himself seems to suggest this in another part of the book, from which I earlier quoted. He says, "In regard to propaganda, the early advocates of universal literacy and a free press envisaged only two possibilities. The propaganda might be true or it might be false. They did not foresee what in fact has happened, the development of a vast mass communications industry, concerned in the main neither with the true nor the false, but with the unreal, the more or less totally irrelevant." I infer from this passage that Huxley does not quite know how to classify totally irrelevant messages, except to say that they are non-rational because they distract people from seeing the truth. Of course, they also distract people from seeing falsehoods, and perhaps on that account, Huxley might think, as I do, that the word propaganda causes more misunderstanding than it resolves. But if the word is to remain with us, then I suggest that we pick up one of Huxley's ideas and use propaganda to refer not to the goodness or badness of causes, but exclusively to a use of language designed to evoke a particular kind of response. We might say, for example, that propaganda is a language that invites us to respond emotionally, emphatically, more or less immediately, and in an either-or manner. It is distinct from language which stimulates curiosity, reveals its assumptions, causes us to ask questions, invites us to seek further information and to search for error. From this perspective, we eliminate the need to distinguish between good and bad propaganda, except in the sense that good propaganda works and bad propaganda doesn't. We eliminate the need to focus on causes and actions and the precarious issue of which ones are in whose enlightened self-interest. And we eliminate the need, which thankfully Huxley does not bring up, but which others have, to distinguish between language that persuades and language that doesn't. Since all language is purposive, even, I am told, the language of paranoid schizophrenics, well, I'll be damned, dead man do bleed. We can assume that talking is always intended as some form of persuasion. Thus, the distinction between persuasion and other types of talking does not seem to be very useful. But the distinction between language that says, believe this, and language that says, consider this, is, in my opinion, certainly worth making, and especially because the techniques of saying, believe this, are so various and sophisticated. Here, for example, are two pieces of propaganda, according to the way in which I have defined the word. The first is of a fairly obvious species, and I think three short paragraphs of it will be about all you can take. It was published in the Indianapolis Star in 1968, about the time the Vietnam War was heating up, and was called A Letter from a War Veteran. It was too bad I had to die in another country. The United States is so wonderful, but at least I died for a reason, and a good one. I may not understand this war, or like it, or want to fight it, but nevertheless I had to do it, and I did. I died for the people of the United States. I died really for you. You were my one real happiness. I died also for your mom and your dad, so that they could go on working. For your brothers, so that they could play sports in freedom without communist rule. It goes on like this for several paragraphs, in the course of which God comes into the picture, along with dad's retirement, vacations, and several other surefire winners. There is, in my opinion, not much to say of interest about this piece of propaganda because it is so obviously constructed to evoke Indianapolis passions in favor of the war. This is not to say that there were no arguments for waging the war, only that no arguments are presented here in any form, and there is no pretense that there are. The rhetorical devices are, so to speak, all up front, and I confess to a certain admiration for the boldness of their sentimentality. Even the admin on Madison Avenue would be ashamed to try to pull this off, and I can't help thinking that there must be something very curious going on in Indiana if this could be done as late as 1968. But the next species of propaganda is another matter. In fact, perhaps in a special way, it illuminates the difference between Indiana stupid talk and New York stupid talk. This one widely circulated among intellectuals in New York when it was the fashion to elevate revolutionaries to sainthood. The propaganda was intended to give us some background information on George Jackson, who was, for a time, a charismatic leader in the movement for black liberation. We are informed that Jackson was a choir boy, that his father was a post office employee, and that Jackson subscribed to conventional values when he was young. We are also told that the circumstances of Jackson's first serious crime were these. One night, a friend whom Jackson had invited for a ride in his car ordered him to stop at a gas station. The friend went inside and stole $70. Then he told Jackson to drive away. Although Jackson was convicted for robbery, we are led to believe that he was almost entirely innocent. The following paragraph telling of Jackson's early life was included in the piece as part of our background information. When Jackson was 15, still too young to drive legally, he had a single accident in his father's car, knocking a few bricks out of the outside wall of a small grocery store near his home. His father paid the damages. The store owner refrained from pressing charges, but he was still sent to reform school for driving without a license. 3 years later, shortly after his release from reform school, he made a down payment on a motorbike, which turned out to have been stolen. His mother had the receipt and produced it for the police, but Jackson was sent back to reform school, this time for theft. I believe that this paragraph is one of the great propagandistic passages of all time and is deserving of being included in the Joseph Goebbels Casebook of Famous Boondoggles. Let us do a small explication of it. When Jackson was 15, still too young to drive legally. Well now, what does this imply? That Jackson was a competent driver, but that the laws governing these matters are unreasonable? Why not still too young to drive? Who or what is in need of correction here, Jackson or the Motor Vehicle Bureau? He had a slight accident in his father's car, knocking a few bricks out of the outside wall of a small grocery store near his home. The diminutives are almost oppressive, A slight accident, a few bricks, a small grocery store. One almost expects to read that someone's trivial leg was barely fractured. And what is a slight accident anyway? Dislodging even a few bricks from an outside wall. It wasn't, for God's sakes, an inside wall. Doesn't sound awfully slight to me. And why are we told it was near his home? Are we led to believe that he had only driven around the block? Best of all is the phrase, in his father's car. Does this imply that George really had nothing to do with the accident? That it happened to him while he was innocently sitting in his father's car? Why not he had a slight accident when he stole his father's car? Or did George's father approve of his taking the car? His father paid the damages, the store owner refrained from pressing charges, but he was still sent to reform school for driving without a license. The "still" is a wonderful piece of propaganda here. It leads us to believe that everything had been settled to everyone's satisfaction, but that the police and the courts were simply being vindictive. After all, it was a small crime, and George was a choir boy. Why the big deal? 3 years later, shortly after his release from reform school, he made a down payment on a motorbike, which turned out to have been stolen. First of all, I'd like to know how shortly after his release. It sounds as if George was in reform school for almost 3 years. Is this true? And why is the information being kept from me? Second, the word down payment is simply marvelous. It conjures an image of a responsible businessman engaged in a wholly legitimate transaction. But George obviously didn't buy the motorbike at Macy's. He must have bought it from someone on the streets who was giving him a real bargain. But the turned out to be stolen suggests that choir boy George never suspected, not even for a moment, that anyone could traffic in stolen property. Where did George grow up? In Beverly Hills? His mother had the receipt and produced it for the police, but Jackson was sent back to reform school, this time for theft. The implication here is that the evidence George's mother produced should have been enough for any reasonable policeman, but apparently it wasn't. What was the evidence against George? Was he convicted of theft without a trial? What did the police have to say at the trial? We are told nothing, left with the impression that George was possibly framed and certainly the victim of a system that was out to get him. Let me stress, in case you have gotten the wrong impression, that I do not know much about the late George Jackson, and most of what I do know evokes my admiration. What I am talking about is a method of propagandizing which attempts to conceal itself as information. The response that is asked for here is, believe this, you are being given all the information you need to know. But I can sooner believe that a soldier would go to war for Mom's apple pie than that a friend of George invited him for a ride, ordered him to stop at a gas station, held up the place, and told him to drive away, while all the time George thought his friend was only going to the bathroom. I would guess that you couldn't get away with that kind of stuff in Indianapolis. In New York, it's easy. Each end of the political spectrum has, I suppose, its own favorite style of propaganda. The right tends to prefer gross, straightforward sentimentality, the left a sort of surface intellectualizing. But it is very important, it seems to me, to note that the response required of us, in each instance, is a passionate, uncritical acceptance of a point of view. I am not implying, by the way, that there is no legitimate function for propaganda. There are several semantic environments. Advertising, for example, where it is quite reasonable for one person to ask another to believe what he is saying. In fact, much of our literature, especially popular literature, amounts to direct appeal to our emotions. To the extent that such appeals are cathartic or entertaining, or in some sense a stimulus to self-discovery, they are invaluable. In other words, propaganda is not by itself a problem, if it comes dressed in its natural clothing, but when it presents itself as something else, regardless of the cause it represents, it is a form of stupid talk that can be, and has been, extremely dangerous. It is dangerous for two reasons. First, propaganda demands a way of responding which can become habitual, if we allow ourselves, too easily, to summon the emotions that our causes require, we may be unable to hold them back when confronted with someone else's causes. And second, propaganda has a tendency to work best on groups rather than individuals. It has the effect of turning groups into crowds, which is what Huxley calls herd poisoning. As he describes it, herd poisoning is an active, extroverted drug. The crowd-intoxicated individual escapes from responsibility, intelligence, and morality into a kind of frantic animal mindlessness. Here, Huxley is talking about what happens when an individual has joined with other individuals in a semantic environment where propaganda, unchecked, is doing its work. Stupid talk is transformed into an orgy of crazy talk, the consequences of which can be found in graves stretching from Siberia to Mississippi to Weimar to Peking. This last sentence is, of course, propaganda, pure and simple, but I like it anyway.
Eichmannism. Eichmannism is a form of talk which takes its name from the notoriously efficient bureaucrat Adolf Eichmann, who was instrumental in arranging for the murder of over 1 million people. Unlike Paul Blobel and other certifiable Nazi psychotics, Eichmann did not appear to be motivated by excessive devotion to his Führer, nor did he believe that those who were being sent to their deaths were suffering less than those who were sending them. And when he stood in the dock on Jerusalem, he actually said, with apparent sincerity, that some of his best friends were Jews. Eichmann was, by most accounts, a fairly reasonable man, and at his trial he maintained that it was unfair and gratuitously vindictive to punish him since he was merely doing his job. It was not his idea to send people to the gas chamber, and in fact, it is fairly clear that he was not the sort of man who naturally thinks of such things. Eichmann merely had extraordinary administrative abilities that made him an excellent choice to solve certain complicated logistical problems. For example, how to get thousands of people onto trains so that they could be moved to a place of extermination. Eichmann himself never visited that place because he felt sure it would make him sick, as indeed it probably would have. The point about Eichmannism is that we all have the potential for it in varying degrees. There is not one of us, I imagine, who has not participated in some process whose goal we did not approve of or whose goal we carefully avoided seeking to know. Yet we participated because our job required it, or someone depended on us. Of course, I do not say that all of us could do what Eichmann did, or anything resembling it, only that, as Professor Milgram demonstrated, we are capable of doing acts of stupidity or cruelty without really meaning to. Milgram explains this by saying that the relationship overwhelms content, by which he means that maintaining our role and status in a situation is apt to be more important to us than the overall purpose of the situation itself. I have no doubt that this explanation is sound, but I should like to broaden it somewhat to include the point of view of the French sociologist Jacques Ellul. To Ellul, a person's relationship to others in a semantic environment is only one aspect of a larger complex of forces, all of which he calls la technique. Technique includes all of the methods, media, and materials through which human behavior is organized and controlled. In this sense, not only are an account book, a conveyor belt, and a television set techniques, but so is a restaurant, its tables, its silverware, its decor, its menus, its waiters. These are all part of a complex ensemble for making people behave in certain ways. Parliamentary procedure is a technique for controlling how people will talk and what they may say. So is a courtroom, a classroom, a barroom, and a living room. Technique, in Ellul's sense, is obviously quite similar to what I have been calling a semantic environment. It is the totality of organizing principles which govern a situation. Now, it frequently happens, as Ellul has abundantly documented, that people become so preoccupied with technique that their power, indeed even will, to think about purpose is greatly diminished. This is especially the case where technique is extremely complex and requires great concentration to learn and to perform adequately. For example, if you have never before been in a restaurant or a courtroom or a classroom, you will, upon entering one, become so engaged in coping with its rules, its language, and its design that you will barely have anything left over to think about why you are there in the first place. But even after you have become accustomed to such situations, the complexity of their techniques is likely to keep you sufficiently busy so that you cannot concentrate on purpose. A simple way of saying this is that the how of a situation tends to overwhelm the why. In fact, it is not unusual for the how to become the why, as for example in our space program, where technique is so complex and demanding and interesting that we end up thinking that the reason we are doing what we are doing is, well, to do what we are doing. I do not say that no one has offered other reasons as to why we go into outer space, but it is obvious that such reasons are thought up after the fact by people who are essentially fascinated, perhaps even hypnotized, by the process. One of the words commonly used to describe people in this condition of preoccupation is technocrat. And up to a point, we are all technocrats, since without a competent interest in and control over the techniques of our environment, nothing could get done. Even a simple conversation between two people involves the use of technique, a practical knowledge of what the rules are. To use technique is no moral defect, nor does it generally generate stupid talk or crazy talk. But what I am here calling Eichmannism is that degree of commitment to technique that makes it come before all other considerations, especially the meaning and consequences of the system within which one is operating. The devoted men who surrounded Richard Nixon were just doing their job, and a difficult one at that. Covering up crimes is hard enough to do without the added burden of deciding whether to do it. The obliviousness to responsibility for consequences is Eichmannism. In America, where complex technique is apt to be highly valued, if not revered, Eichmannism is a fairly familiar kind of talk, and it is important to say that it is almost always polite, subdued, and sometimes even gracious, in a plastic sort of way. A friend of mine once received a letter from an administrator which began, "We are pleased to inform you that your scholarship for the coming academic year has been canceled." That "pleased to inform you" tells us a great deal. That the person who wrote it really did not understand what his letter was about or what its consequences might be. Perhaps he did not want to understand. The important thing was to get the letter done and go on to the next matter of business. My most treasured Eichmannism, however, comes from a school teacher who addressed the following letter to ninth grade students just before the Christmas holidays. It is worth reading, I think, because it contains all the symptoms of the problem in an exquisitely compact form. "Dear student, may I take this opportunity to wish each and every one a very holy and merry holiday season. Kindly extend this greeting to the members of your household and those who will help you celebrate this festive time of year. Writers remind us constantly that with the arrival of a new year, we must become cognizant of the fact that it is time to proclaim our New Year resolutions. As a class, let us accept for the theme of the new year the ever-powerful meaning of the need and desire for enthusiasm. Remember, my dear students, that enthusiasm can and will achieve the unheard of and miraculous recesses of your heart, the need for enthusiasm. An unknown writer once said, carry enthusiasm in your attitude and manner. It spreads like a contagion. It begets and inspires effects that you did not dream of. To aid and guide you on your pathway to learning, the following assignments will help you to activate vehemently your newly acquired aim, enthusiasm. Number 1. A vocabulary test will be given the day you return to school. Period 1. Nouns and verbs and workaday words. Period 4. The words which were given to you on Monday, December 10th. Number 2. Oral book reports will be given the first week of school. Prepare to answer the following questions about the book you read. Number 1, give the title, author, publisher, and date of publication. Number 2, what was the theme of the story? Number 3, what was the setting of the story? Discuss the importance of the setting in this particular story. Number 4, do a character study of one major character. Be sure to give specific information from the reading that will back up any general statement you may make about this character. We must remember the reality of the fact that we are beginning a program of study that will mold our future. This presents to us responsibilities. I did not prepare this epistle to harass you, but I sincerely wish to prepare you for the demands of high school and college with which some of you will be confronted in the near future. I once again extend to you and your family my season's greetings." What this letter is about, of course, is a couple of tests and assignments which the teacher is rather hard put to justify. I would almost go so far as to say that what this teacher's classroom is about is tests and assignments, the purposes of which have long since been forgotten, if they were ever known. To conceal their absence, even from himself, the teacher surrounds the assignments with fairly preposterous homilies and long-range projections of how they will activate vehemently your newly acquired aim, enthusiasm. This is a rather pathetic attempt to raise to a level of glory a more or less trivial technique of measurement. Is it conceivable that a ninth grade student anywhere in the world would prepare for those post-holiday assignments with the expectation that in doing so, he or she is assuming new and life-giving responsibilities? And yet, there is no irony in the language of this letter. This is serious business, and in that respect, it is choice Eichmannism. Eichmannism is talk that tries to ennoble technique, to make it appear that the kingdom of heaven awaits those who follow the proper routine. One may find such talk in many semantic environments throughout our culture. In sex manuals, for example, where it is generally implied that joy does not come from why sex is done, but how. Or in guides to raising children, where you discover that your failure as a parent derives almost solely from ignorance of the proper technique. Every book like this one runs the risk of creating the impression that crazy talk or stupid talk is merely a matter of one's using the wrong technique. That is why I have taken such pains to emphasize the purposes of talk. To talk about talk without respect to purpose is an example of Eichmannism. And yet, Eichmannism has some curious variations. There is, for example, what I call Skinnerism, which, of course, takes its name from America's foremost behaviorist, B.F. Skinner. Skinnerism is, in one sense, the opposite of Eichmannism, but in another sense, they are the same. It is the opposite in that it appears to be goal or purpose-oriented. It is a technique for producing specific changes in behavior. It asks of you, what sort of behavior do you feel is desirable? And then it proceeds through operant conditioning to produce such behavior. But it is the same as Eichmannism in that its practitioners do not sufficiently appreciate the power of technique to influence purpose. They assume that it makes no difference how you arrive at some goal as long as you get there. Reason, fear, and approval are only a means to an end, and a positive reinforcement is chosen because it is the most efficient. If fear were more so, it would be used instead. But that is the quintessential fallacy of Eichmannism. Eichmannism represents the triumph of technique. It may take the form of our downgrading ends in favor of means, or it may take the subtler form of downgrading the means by which we will achieve our ends. To say that I do not want to think about why I am doing this, only about how I do it, is not very different from saying, I do not want to think about how I am doing this, only about why. In both instances, technique reigns supreme. In the former, because we have given it all our consideration. In the latter, because we have given it none. Definition: tyranny. One of the more curious federal laws now in existence concerns what you may not say when being frisked or otherwise examined before boarding an airplane. You may not, of course, give false or misleading information about yourself. But beyond that, you are also expressly forbidden to joke about any of the procedures being used. This is the only semantic environment I know of where a joke is prohibited by law, although there are many situations in which it is prohibited by custom. Why joking is illegal when you are being searched is not entirely clear to me, but that is only one of several mysteries surrounding this law. Does the law distinguish, for example, between good jokes and bad jokes? 6 months for a good one, 2 years for a bad one? I don't know. But even more important, how would one know when something is a joke at all? Suppose, while being searched, I mention that my middle name is Milton, which it is, and that I come from Flushing, which I do. I can tell you from experience that people of questionable intelligence sometimes find those names extremely funny, and it is not impossible that a few of them are airport employees. If that were the case, what would be my legal status? I have said something which has induced laughter in another. Have I, therefore, told a joke? Or look at it from the opposite view. Suppose that, upon being searched, I launched into a story about a funny thing that happened to me while boarding a plane in Chicago, concluding with the line, and then the pilot said, "That was no stewardess, that was my wife." Being of questionable intelligence myself, I think it is a hilarious story, but the guard does not. If he does not laugh, have I told a joke? Can a joke be a story that does not make people laugh? It can, of course, if someone of authority says so. For the point is that in every situation, including this one, someone or some group has a decisive power of definition. In fact, to have power means to be able to define and to make it stick. As between the guard at the airport and me, he will have the power, not me, to define what a joke is. If his definition places me in jeopardy, I can, of course, argue my case at a trial, at which either a judge or a jury will then have the decisive authority to define whether or not my words qualified as a joke. But it is also worth noting that even if I confine my joke-telling to dinner parties, I do not escape the authority of definition. For at parties, popular opinion will decide whether or not my jokes are good ones, or even jokes at all. If opinion runs against me, the penalty is that I am not invited to many parties. There is, in short, no escaping the jurisdiction of definitions. Social order requires that there be established definitions, sometimes fixed and formal, sometimes fluid and informal. And though you may search from now to doomsday, you will find no system without official definitions of some sort and authoritative sources of some sort to enforce them. Some people, however, are greatly tyrannized by definitions. They seem unable to put any distance between themselves and a system's way of defining things. I am not talking here about one's accepting a definition on pragmatic grounds. This may be necessary in order to function within a system. You may think, for example, that defining a corporation as a person is pretty silly stuff, but you will have to accept it if you are to understand and participate in America's corporate structure. What I am talking about is people who have so internalized a definition that they cannot even imagine an alternative way of seeing matters. They make a definition into the definition, and as a consequence, sharply limit their ability to evaluate what is happening to them. After all, one ought to know what is happening, even if one cannot always change it. Here, for example, is the beginning of a letter written by a college student who has, happily for him, refused to internalize the psychological legitimacy of a certain definition, although he accepts, no doubt, its legality. Dear admission officer, I am in receipt of your rejection of my application. As much as I would like to accommodate you, I find I cannot accept it. I have already received 4 rejections from other colleges, and this number is, in fact, over my limit. Therefore, I must reject your rejection. And as much as this might convenience you, I expect to appear for classes on September 18th. More than likely, this letter will not change the status of the student, but it reveals a certain liberated spirit to his way of thinking. He is a grown-up version of the little child in The Emperor's New Clothes. He will insist upon putting forward his own definition of the situation, even if others will not see it that way, and even if it will not change things. He has, in fact, reversed the system's definition. It was not his application that was inadequate, it is the college's rejection slip. It goes almost without saying, then, that I regard our capacity to maintain a certain psychological distance from conventional definitions to be a valuable asset in protecting ourselves against the onset of stupid or crazy talk. To have to speak someone else's words, to have all our attitudes governed by someone else's definitions, can be a very dangerous situation. Therefore, you might find it useful in avoiding definition tyranny to consider the following questions the next time you are told that something is or is not a joke, a sin, a failure, an illness, or anything else. Who or what is the source of the definition? What is the source of its, his, her authority? Political power, economic power, legal power, tradition power, public opinion power, knowledge power? Here I might say that some people derive their authority from the fact that they know more than the rest of us. If you are a novice skier, for example, you will usually allow an experienced skier to define what are safe conditions. If you are not feeling well, you will probably permit a physician to define what medication is. To what extent have you participated in granting this authority? To what extent do you regard the method by which it was granted to be rational, just, moral, etc.? What attitudes towards yourself and others are promoted by this definition? What are some of its important consequences? What assumptions about people underlie the definition? What alternative definitions are you aware of? Who are the people who have offered them? What are their motives? What purposes might they have in mind? To what extent can you play a role in changing the definition? Who will be helped by a different definition? Who will be hurt? Finally, I should like to put before you a relevant observation made by Paul Watzlawick et al. In The Pragmatics of Human Communication. Quote, "Crazy communication, behavior, is not necessarily the manifestation of a sick mind, but may be the only possible reaction to an absurd or untenable communication context," unquote. There are 2 ideas here worth thinking about, in my opinion. The first is that it sometimes happens that we find ourselves in an environment whose definitions are so utterly irrational that we can at no point grant their legitimacy without becoming crazy. If, for example, we are part of a system which defines certain groups of people as subhuman, example, blacks and Jews, we cannot accept such definitions without fairly soon beginning to talk and act a little crazy. The second idea is that if we reject such a definition and refuse to act on it, those to whom the definition seems reasonable will think us crazy. And so it would appear that we lose either way. We are crazy when we accept irrational or evil definitions, and we are crazy when we do not, if everyone else does. It is a bad situation, but I am inclined to think that the second crazy has given our species some of its finest moments. The first has not, and I think never will. Sloganeering. Maybe it is true, and maybe it isn't, that battles are won on the playing fields of schools. But certainly something is lost there, for on playing fields and in gymnasiums everywhere, people are encouraged to practice a peculiar variety of stupid talk, which they later on bring to perfection at political rallies and other rituals of mass ecstasy. I am referring to what I call sloganeering, which, in the wrong semantic environment, can be transformed into an especially lethal form of crazy talk. Sloganeering consists largely of ritualistic utterances that are intended to communicate solidarity. On, Wisconsin, would be a typical example. Power to the people would be another. Let's go, Mets, would be another one. And of course, Sieg Heil. It would be shallow to deny that such highly ritualistic sayings and or chantings have some useful social functions and may even satisfy a deep-rooted aesthetic need. Children, for example, will frequently indulge in singing slogans at each other, and at religious ceremonies, there are many occasions where the congregation sings, chants, or speaks certain prayers, whose power is amplified by the collective recitation. And of course, almost everyone loves a community sing. Apparently, there is something to this form of group talking that is part of what people call human nature. It is surely one of the principal ways by which we may suppress our individuality and align ourselves wholeheartedly with a community sentiment. One might even say that community consciousness is given its most direct expression through such group performances. If you add to this the aesthetic satisfaction most of us derive from simply saying meaningless words like Barney Google with the goo-goo googly eyes, you can account for the universal practice of group chanting, cheering, and screaming. I do not intend to say, therefore, that in all circumstances such verbal behavior is either stupid or crazy. If Columbia is on the verge of pulling off the upset of the century over Michigan State, provided it can move the ball 3 yards in 4 tries, almost any reasonable man will scream his lungs out in the hopes that the gods which control such matters are also reasonable and will hear. Nonetheless, I do think it is worth remarking, briefly, on the dangers of such behavior. The distance between go, go, go Lions and off the Pigs is not so great as some people suppose. A man who would say the former is at least a candidate for saying the latter, unless he has matters firmly under control. The first thing, then, that needs to be stressed is that sloganeering, by definition, is a repudiation of individual thought, another example of what Huxley calls herd poisoning. Even when the slogan comes from the mouth of a single person, as when someone says or used to say, right on, we are hearing group speak, not an individual. The purpose of such slogans is to signal that one is a member of a special class of people. This is accomplished by saying exactly what any other member of the group would say. Sometimes this can be very useful in helping you to know what sort of situation you are in. For example, if you should say hello to someone and get a reply such as, the Lord be with you, or power to the people, brother, you will know how to prepare yourself for the next few minutes. Of course, hello is, in itself, a highly ritualized remark, a slogan, if you will, but it does not commit you to any other classification than that of an English-speaking member of the human race. Moreover, hello, good morning, or any similar expression merely indicates a desire to engage in a civilized transaction. It does not imply that you adhere to any special religions, political, or social doctrine. That implication is, of course, characteristic of the type of sloganeering I am talking about. It is a form of groupthink. It says, this is what we believe, not this is what I believe. Or more precisely, it says, this is what we feel, since most slogans cannot exactly be called beliefs. All power to the people, for example, hardly qualifies as a human thought. Or, if it does, its meaning, as anything but a group marker, is hopelessly muddled. Very few sloganeers who have used this expression could possibly want the people to have all the power, since, I would guess, Very few sloganeers who have used this expression could possibly want the people to have all that power, since, I would guess, a majority of people in this country are opposed to the various causes which such a sloganeer usually favors. More likely, the sloganeer means all power to our people, and to hell with the others, which is a thought of sorts and a delightfully candid one at that, but it would not make an entirely satisfactory slogan. It lacks, for example, a sing-song meter. In fact, if you change all power to the people to some obviously meaning phrase such as all putty to the pee-pee, you can hear how delightful is its music. Thus, all power to our people and to hell with the others would not be grounds alone. But it also lacks the moral authority that a reputable slogan tries to project. An important characteristic of most slogans is that they will try to convey a high moral stance, as for example in Free All Political Prisoners, or Keep America Beautiful, or Make Love, Not War. The moral purity of these slogans is achieved mostly through their simplicity, the elimination of all contradiction and ambiguity. To introduce a note of discord, or to suggest that there are those who would suffer at your hands, would result in reflection, not fervor. In short, the key to a good slogan is that it makes no distinctions other than the basic one between good guys and bad guys. Slogans, after all, are intended to go beyond our reasoning and penetrate to places where our emotions are stored. What they hope to elicit is an instantaneous response, or what some semanticists call a signal reaction. A signal reaction is what happens when words have lost their referential or symbolic aspect and instead assume the character of religious icons. A good Christian, for example, is not usually expected to inquire into what a crucifix stands for or how it came to be used. In the presence of a crucifix, he is expected to react, to feel. For a crucifix is not exactly a thought, but a catalyst for the release of emotions. In saying this, I am not ridiculing the use of crucifixes or other religious icons. Within the semantic environment of religion, as well as, for example, the theater, signal reactions are entirely necessary and useful. But when the signal reaction becomes the standard method of response in semantic environments, where inquiry and complex thought are required, we are on very dangerous ground. Deutschland über alles is not exactly human language. It is, like the American flag, a command to feel, and we are not expected to ask why, or what does it mean, or where does it come from. Better red than dead. Freedom now. Liberty, equality, and fraternity. These are icons whose effect is to reduce the range and power of human insight. They imply that certain questions have been settled, or that there was no question to begin with, and that all that is required is collective commitment and passion. As I suggested earlier, the roots of sloganeering doubtless go very deep, and there are a few semantic environments in which some form of mindless recitation is not encouraged. Sloganeering is, in fact, practiced in seemingly inexhaustible variety in pledges, oaths, banners, bumper stickers, college cheers, mantras, wherever it appears desirable to ease the burden of individual responsibility for thinking a matter through. As a general rule, whenever you find yourself applauding, cheering, or chanting in a public place, you may suspect that your intelligence has been bypassed and that someone has raised before your eyes a verbal crucifix. Knowing this, you may wish to applaud, cheer, or chant anyway, on the grounds that it is good for you to let go. Or perhaps you will feel the need to submerge yourself in a collectivized mood. But unless there is some part of you that knows exactly what is happening and which has retained the option to withdraw, you are participating in a fairly dangerous exhibition of stupid talk.
Context of white supremacy. First audio segment of Neil Postman. Crazy talk, stupid talk, how we defeat ourselves by the way we talk and what to do about it. Legendary segment of audio on the context of white supremacy. This is a book, unlike the previous book that we read on the book club. If nobody was listening at all, I would have a hoot talking about this book and just what we read today alone. I would have a hoot chatting by myself for the next 15, 20 minutes, and then we can move on to the next one. If you have commentary, the number 641-715-3640. the code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Actually, star 61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 641-715-3640. The code 564-943-pound. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. If you would like to use the free vote line, if you don't want to call in on your phone, it's linked, the vote line, it's linked at Black Talk Radio Network. If you need the address, it is tinyty.cc/oneRace. And that is the number one. Address again, tinyty.cc/oneRace. Once you enter that address, look on the left of the page. You will see the link for the free vote line. Click that. It will open a small window on your screen. The first line, it's a drop-down menu. Select the number I just gave out, which again is 641-715-3640. Next line, it will ask for the code. That code again is 564-943. Final line, it will ask for a name. You can put in a real name. You can press random keys, whatever you're comfortable with. Once you get all that information entered, click the green button at the bottom. It will connect you to the broadcast. You should be able to hear us live. Same procedure if you would like to participate. You'll see the dial pad on your screen. Press star 61 if you would like to participate. That's it. If folks have commented, and I have a question, any listener, if you heard, if you've been keeping up with Neil Postman, right? Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk. If you were with us for Wretched of the Earth, Franz Fanon, or if you just, you read Wretched of the Earth, you didn't even have to have, you know, been with us for the book study for it. But if you were with us for Wretched of the Earth, or if you've read it on your own, which book do you think has more constructive information that you can apply in a practical sense? Wretched of the Earth, Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk. I would appreciate feedback from any and everyone who is participating live today. If you've been following with this book, if you heard Franz Fanon, or if you read it on your own, which book has more constructive value? Folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Feel free. Let's see. Mr. Dimrefor, I'll nab other folks as we proceed.
Yes, may I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Okay, greetings, Gus. Greetings to the callers and listeners. To answer your question, there's no doubt that this book is more constructive. It has more techniques, methods, strategies, things that we can learn that can help us immediately encountering racism. So that's my take on that. In the first part in Propaganda, his first sentence, he identified propaganda as mischievous. So I guess then the question came up whether there's a such thing as good propaganda, bad propaganda. And giving it some thought in my mind, I always looked at propaganda in a negative fashion, and then there would be no good or bad propaganda. Propaganda on its own would be considered bad in my view. But if you, well, he broke it down a little bit more. The good propaganda would be rational. Bad propaganda would be non-rational, and the non-rational appeals to the passion, but the rational propaganda appeals to the intellect. You know, I don't know if I agree with that concept, because first of all, propaganda is the use of words or some type of symbols or some form of communication that will solicit a response, the desired response from an individual, whereas that may not, the individual may or may not know that this response is being manipulated from him. And I think that anytime there is a interaction between one or more people, and then there's a chance that one or more individuals can be hurt or mistreated in any way, then that particular act, I think, is deemed, you know, unconstructive. It's not right. So when propaganda, in my assessment, when propaganda is used maliciously, in a malicious manner, to gain the results that would obviously be in the self-interest of the source of that propaganda, then given the individual or the group believe this or consider this, but then they're manipulating the situation so that you would believe a certain way, it's commonly, I thought of any synonyms for propaganda, there are none. So propaganda is a word that stands by itself. It either means something or it don't. He gave a few examples, the drug commercial, where they don't tell you the side effects of the drug. It may help your immediate symptoms, but you don't know until later on that it was going to wreck some internal organs. Or the example about the politician, the political candidate, that you don't know whether he's going to be good for the people or not until after he's in. And we all know in most cases that, you know, they all lie to get into office. So that usually doesn't work out as a good thing. Propaganda has a tendency to work best on groups rather than individuals. And all these examples he was given, I was just wondering why he didn't give the example that it seems it has the effect of turning groups into crowds and crowds into mobs, similar to the white mobs that has been terrorizing black people for hundreds of years. That would have been a good example, but he failed to bring that up. Instead, excuse me, he goes into Eichmann, who, in my view, was an inhumane monster, the Nazi officer that stood on the docks in Jerusalem and actually said with apparent sincerity that some of his best friends were Jews in past tense, while he was sending millions of them off to death. And looking at your job and not looking at the entire process, only the methods or the techniques, strategies or whatever that you're going to use to make your position better or your job more efficient, is obviously a wrong move. And that was an exaggeration of somebody going to the extreme of handling their business as far as doing an efficient job. I thought that it may have been a act of racism when he referred to George Jackson. We know Mr. Jackson was associated with the Black Panthers and Angela Davis during the late 60s, I think early 70s. And then he was not a popular figure for white people during that time. So it seems the author was using his information in a way that was not complimentary to Mr. Jackson. He put it in contrast with a letter from a war veteran from Vietnam as good and bad propaganda. And then in the end, he said the right tends to prefer the gross, straightforward sentimentality, but the left, a sort of surface intellectualizing. So he puts, the group who thinks, one way to the right and the other group to the left. And I think, Gus, that's something that you already touched on a little early. And then last, the sloganeering, communicating solidarity. I don't think a slogan like power to the people would carry the same connotation or definition as Sieg Heil in German, which is a German salute, a victory salute, Nazi salute, that I guess was showing solidarity to Hitler and hatred for all non-whites. And those who classify themselves as white determine which slogans are acceptable. And I say that because in the slogan Black Lives Matter, that slogan is not given the acceptance in a system of racism, white supremacy. I'll mute my line, Gus. Thanks for taking the call. Give somebody else a chance.
Indeed, indeed. Appreciate that. Mr. Demery, for right on time. I did say comment about the left and right. With the propaganda, I think that was he started with Postman. I think he started with Aldous Huxley's definition of propaganda. Like he gives a couple different quotes at the very beginning of the chapter on propaganda, where he's talking about different types of propaganda. One is an appeal to intellect and one is rational. And then eventually, after a few pages, Postman finally says that these don't make any sense. Like he critiques what Huxley is saying. And Huxley wrote Brave New World, right, for listeners. We have not done that book on the book club, although it has been suggested many times. And then later on page 170, Postman finally says, I suggest we pick up one of Huxley's ideas and use propaganda, and he puts it in quotes, to refer not to the goodness or badness of causes, but exclusively to a use of language designed to evoke a particular kind of response. We might say, for example, that propaganda is language that invites us to respond emotionally, emphatically, more or less immediately, and in an either or manner. And he specifies, he says, from this perspective, we eliminate the need to distinguish between good and bad propaganda, and except in the sense that good propaganda, in quotes, works, is effective at getting people to respond immediately, emotionally, etc. And bad propaganda, in quotes, does not work, so people do not move. That's the conclusion that I think Postman comes to about what he means when he says propaganda and quote unquote, what's good propaganda, what's bad propaganda. He was talking about Huxley's definitions at first, unless I misinterpreted. If other folks had thoughts around that or think I misread, feel free to share. I think our narrator is with us as well. Mel doing grand work and her partner with the sound editing. Did you have commentary as well? Not hearing. Don't know if you hit your mute button. Still not hearing from Mel. We'll give her a second or two, see if she, any of the other folks that are listening in while we get our audio together on Mel's line, feel free, *61. If you have commentary, and again, if you've been following along as we've been reading this book, if you read Wretched of the Earth on your own, or if you were with us for the book study, which book, more constructive, practical information that, you know, you could pass along, you know, in a way to help you counter racism, white supremacy. Let's see, Emmy is here as well. Then we'll check in with Mel after Emmy's commentary. Emmy, if you have commentary, wonderful to hear from you as always.
Greetings. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Fantastic. I did participate in The Wretched of the Earth. I hadn't read it before, so that was my first time. This book, Stupid Talk, Crazy Talk, is more constructive for a few reasons, but I think one for me specifically is that it's specific and clear to me what we're talking about, and it provides information to give me things to actually think about later. I didn't actually have that same kind of feeling with Wretched of the Earth. It just didn't do much for me. So I think hands down, this book is far more constructive. I think I have to agree with Mr. Jimmy Ford. I think he was saying that it could have been a potential act of racism, the way that he was saying power to the people and trying to connect that. It felt that he spent far more time talking about that as an example of propaganda and not all of the other white statements or statements made by white people that are propaganda. And I'm not so sure. I understand what he was trying to say, but I think it was circular reasoning or something. It wasn't that effective. When I took a psychology class and I first heard about that study over, I think at Berkeley or whatever, where they took the college students and turned some of them into prisoners and the other ones into prison guards, and the study had to be shut down because it didn't take them very long before they began to like really take their role seriously. I was slightly fascinated by it when I first heard it. So, and it's been used many times in many different contexts to describe certain things. But one thing that I think is so interesting about that study is it was all white people and white males. But I don't think that it would have been different had they been females. I was just saying that they are white males. And that just gets kind of like discarded or just not mentioned. And I think that's very important because it gets, I'm forgetting the term, is it extrapolated or whatever? Like it gets blown out of proportion and put on to everybody as if everybody would do that under the same circumstances. And that's not true. That's not true at all. So I reject that. What else? Let's see. I thought it was very fitting that he kept talking or he described a particular way of speaking as Iceman. And I was like, I'm not so sure if Iceman Inheritance was out at the time. I'm not so sure when that text was written. But if Stupid Talk, Crazy Talk preceded Iceman, that's very, very interesting. And then it would, if that was the case, and I wonder, did the author of Iceman Inheritance read Stupid Talk, Crazy Talk? And or did these, are these things completely independent of each other? And here are two white males describing something that's very white as Iceman. And the fact that he doesn't even go into that so much, like, or maybe I could have missed it. Unfortunately, I am not following along with the text. I was just listening. So maybe that, like, I missed that part. But to describe something as Iceman, but like not say white people coming, you know, from out of the Ice Age and coming up with this way, because to like, when I began learning about when they wanted to make the dichotomous existence of Eurocentric and Afrocentric thinking and ways of being and whatnot, which are true, I can totally see that, but I kind of reject it too, because they try to make it seem that only white people are linear, logical, rational, scientific, mathematic, systematic thinking, and that's their way of being, while African is all emotional and spiritual and like non-concrete, non-scientific, non-mathematical. And I reject that. That's not true. But I do think that what this author was saying when he said about the Iceman, that it being like a technical thing, I do see that in white people, that they are very much very technical. Like the way that they set up their systems, the way that they do things is very I don't want to say specific because then that would mean that we're not specific and I reject that, but I will try to figure out a better way to say it. But I had a thought and I'm still ruminating on that thought because of how he described this, like Iceman communicating, Iceman speaking and Iceman thinking. And I just have to bear in mind, because the author also writes this as if this is so and has always been and will always be. And I know he's talking about English, but, or, you know, he's referring to, it's to me just very white. Like there's a lot of other people and a lot of other ways of communicating, a lot of other ways of being, a lot of other ways of conceptualizing and having perceptions about things. Unfortunately, we live in a global system of white supremacy. So this kind of thinking and talking and communicating has been spread everywhere, but it's not natural. It is not innate and it's not perpetual, like forever. And it's just the way that he speaks about it. It's like from that authoritative place, although he does give his disclaimer previously in earlier parts of the text, it's just, for me, important to keep in mind. I have more, but I will pause here. I thank you all for listening.
Appreciate that, Emmy. For clarification, it's Eichmannism, like I-K-E, Mike and Ike. That's the way it's pronounced, not Iceman. So he's saying Eichmannism, E-I-C-H-M-A-N-N-I-S-M, Eichmannism, not ice.
Okay.
And the Iceman Inheritance was published in 1991 by Mr. Bradley. He was on the program in 2009. And this book, Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk, was published in 1976. So about 25 years ahead of Mr. Bradley's work.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you had, other folks who had a hand up, if you had commentary, line should be open. Proceed. I think we got Mel on the other line and the other folks dialed in. Let's see.
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. So this, up to this point in the reading, this book is just really making me realize how my words have been just running me ragged, and just making me realize the value of words as tools and devices to really just get things done. Like I've been saying, I think words as actions for the past few weeks, and this book is really cementing that. It's been really valuable. And on that note, I think Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk for me has just been a little bit more relevant personally than, I guess, the parts of The Wretched of the Earth that I was able to listen in on. But I wasn't able to listen in on the whole text. So so far, this has been more relevant to me, possibly for that reason. So the sections of the book, the war veteran letter was nauseating. But I'm not sure why it was so shocking. And so I'm not sure why the author would say that it was a bold statement to make the letter, that it was a bold form of propaganda, because I'm thinking about how the NRA just like recently put out an ad talking about like taking back their safety or protecting white women or something like that. And from what I've understood, the NRA has always been doing that, like running really bold campaigns. And I think the Klan used to run campaigns back in the day, not even in the South. I mean, just like leaflets and stuff like that. So I don't really find this to be a bold form of propaganda. Maybe I need to do my research on marketing. And then on page 71, he says, and I just think this is an interesting phrase or an interesting paragraph, but I'm not quite sure what it means to me yet. When he talks about how it was fashionable at that time in New York City to elevate revolutionaries to sainthood, and he uses like the word among intellectuals in the next sentence, those two words. And I'm trying to, it's just something about that whole two sentences sounds really interesting to me, and I'm not sure exactly what about it strikes me yet. But about the article about George Jackson, I understand why he picked a crime story to be shown as propaganda, but I can't help but wonder why he chose a black person, a black male, a black revolutionary for that matter. Like, I can't see using someone I admired or liked as the subject of an example of something I disagreed with and basically plan to question sarcastically in a book. Maybe I need to reread the actual article that he posted in the book, or the article itself, but I felt like the manner of his questioning was kind of objectifying the innocent George Jackson portrayed in the story and not the writer, who goes unnamed even if his like newspaper gets put on blast, or I'm sorry, gets mentioned, because of the way he was depicting George Jackson in the story. Even parts where he was like, was he convicted of theft without a trial or a vindictive system out to get him? And in my head, I'm thinking, that's all historically true, though. That occasionally happens to us. And then I kind of agree with the other callers when he was saying that when he picks, I thought he kind of picked on the slogan power to the people a little bit. And it makes me wonder about his political views, because I'm guessing that in the 1970s, when the book is written, there's got to be a lot of other political slogans going on, like the My Body, My Choice with the feminists and other stuff like that. So I'm kind of interested now in Googling his political views. And then the section Definition Tyranny, the power to define is emphasized. And I thought that was really good. It makes me, sorry, hold on just a second. It makes me think of Neely Fuller's making a definition for a word and a state of being that does not exist, that being justice. And it also makes me think of Neely Fuller's lack of being able to find a clear definition for justice. I think that that means that there might not be a human authority for it, because it seems like no one created a consistent and cohesive definition on which everyone operates. Like, it seems like there are authorities for money because it's been defined. And maybe there are some authorities for cooking because people can generally agree on what cooking is. But I'm just always also reminded that the white supremacists are maintaining something that is not justice, even though it's literally in their Pledge of Allegiance. And then lastly, in the section sloganeering at the bottom of page 196, it talks about where sloganeering is being practiced as wherever it appears desirable to ease the burden of individual responsibility for thinking a matter through. That's the quote. And I'm thinking that white privilege to me seems like a slogan and also a lie, but Postman didn't say that a slogan has to be true, but it kind of seems like a gentle language intended to collectively uplift white supremacists when they're all together, like a white privilege conference, I guess. So those are all my points. If I can figure out what I meant by the part where he was talking about the fashionable in New York to elevate revolutionaries, I'll come back to it.
Awesome, Mel. Appreciate that. I will ponder on that sentence also. I put a star next to it so that I can think on it and come back. If other folks have commentary that they want to share as well, number again, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Took lots of notes. I'm going to see if I can be succinct. I thought the focus on Aldous Huxley and George Orwell, like a lot of this book is reifying like white thinkers, like just consistently. It's as I said, it's Orwell, it's Huxley, it's a lot of different white people that are pinpointed as folks of reference, folks that you should look to be authorities, experts on language or whatever the subject happens to be, literature. When he finally gets to a definition of propaganda, I thought that definition was great. I read it when Mr. Demery, when I was speaking about what Mr. Postman actually means when he talks about propaganda, when he gives his own definition, saying that it's to motivate people to do something and generally to respond emotionally and immediately in whatever it is that they're supposed to carry out. I thought that veteran, the letter from a veteran, that sounded like something that I could hear right now, and they just continue in a harangue about Colin Kaepernick and the NFL protesters. Like, I feel like I could hear that right now, and it wouldn't be, you know, oh my goodness, I can't believe that they, it would just be, yeah, that's right, man. Make our country great again. And those SOPs, like, I could hear that right now, even from the White House steps, maybe. When he continues, oh, this is the passage Mel talked about, the whole passage about George Jackson. Wow, I've said for years, for me, sometimes it is most challenging reading white authors when we have white guests on the program, John Potash, this coming Sunday, because sometimes, often, they will have constructive information in the system of white supremacy. It's much easier for whites to get access to resources, information. A lot of times they will have information, accurate information. Whether or not you get access to that is one thing. And then, if it's a book or what have you, you might have to one paragraph the accurate information, the next paragraph you got to hear them talk trash about George Jackson. Wow. And even as he was going within the paragraph, some of the things that he was pointing out, I thought were incredibly important. Like, I thought it was an act, could have been an act of white supremacy when he takes issue with when Jackson was 15, it was written when Jackson was 15, still too young to drive legally. Well, now, what does this imply? That Jackson was a competent driver, but that the laws governing these matters are unreasonable? In 2017, it is legal to drive in many areas at the age of 15. I know I had a learner's permit at 15, and I know 15-year-olds in Washington State who got their driver's license where they could go out and drive. And I think it's even lower than that. I think it's been lower. I think you could drive legally at 14 at some time. So, yeah, I do think that that's relevant and exactly goes to what Mel said, how easily blacks, even right now, 2017, like George Jackson, Tamir Rice can be arrested and outright killed. Continuing, when he gets down to that bottom part, so the article about Jackson says he had a slight accident in his father's car, knocking a few bricks out of the outside wall of a small grocery store near his home. And this is Postman. The diminutives are almost oppressive. Wow, what a word. He's being oppressed hearing a black male talked about not as a thug and who was arrested and someone saying, hey, I think this was a minor crime. This wasn't a big deal. He is being oppressed with these descriptions. A slight accident, a few bricks, a small grocery store. One almost expects to read that someone's trivial leg was barely fractured. And it's got to go to violence. Nothing violent here. He hit a grocery store. That's it. And what is a slight accident anyway? Dislodging even a few bricks from an outside wall? It wasn't, for God's sake, an inside wall. Doesn't sound awfully slight to me. And why are we told it was near his home? Are we being led to believe that he only had driven around the block? Question mark. All of that is fine. If you want to ask all of those questions, what I would submit is that consistently, this is not done. You get the exact opposite. When that white guy went out there in Colorado this week and shot up that Walmart, they did not immediately come out and say, oh my God, we have had another terrorist incident. This is an out. They do not. They go diminutives. Did he have any problems? Was there a mental health issue? This was not terrorism. They do the exact opposite. And then when it's a black person, they don't do the diminutives like what he's talking about here with George Jackson. It is way aggressive and way criminalized. Now, if we're going to ask all these questions that he asks here, it should be across the board because this is not standard. In fact, that would be the position that I would take in terms of, I think this is an act of racism, Mr. Postman singling out George Jackson. This is not the standard in terms of propaganda that you're going to see, a black person being painted as a saint. What you're going to see is Donald Trump, anybody, pick the white person, the NPR editor, Harvey Weinstein. That's what it's going to be. These guys in some way being minimized, not quite a terrorist. He's not quite so bad. Influenza, if they have to make up new terms, that's what it's going to be. Not George Jackson, who was killed. That's the other point I meant to get in. This guy was killed. He wrote this book after a suspicious death in police custody. Why would I pick this person to say, oh, yeah, this is standard illustration, great illustration of propaganda. Somebody who was assassinated under suspicious circumstances not that long ago. This book was 76. I think he was assassinated in early 1970s. I think it might have been 70, 71. I'll double check before we go off the air. Continuing. Oh, and it took up so much space. He devoted so much time to the George Jackson piece. He did not devote nearly this much attention to the white Vietnam editor. I thought the receipt aspect of that was important, too, because having that sort of written documentation, written words, Dr. Marimba Ani talked about that in Yerugu, written documentation normally carries some sort of authority in white court of law. But apparently that was not the case, even when they did produce a receipt that he had put down some funds for the stolen motorbike. Just the fact that it took up so much time, it seemed like this really aggrieved him. This didn't sound like someone that I agree with Mel. This did not sound like the description of someone that he admired or thought well of. And at least this has done one thing for me. I do not have to think about the audio we'll start with next week. I have to go back and make a sound clip. And so you all can hear what Mr. Postman had to say some 20 years after this book was published, what he thought about O.J. Simpson. Woo! That'll be next week, next Friday. We wrap the book up. The chapter on Eichmannism, this just sounded like total white supremacy. This is whites all day long justifying. I thought it was great, great use of an example here to pick a Nazi. This is whites, racist man, racist woman all day long, where they justify, I'm not racist, my best friends are niggers or Jews or whatever it is, and justifying all sorts of criminal activity, poisoning the water in Flint or whatever criminal mischief they have carried out for the day. The use of the term fair, wow, just in the paragraph where he's talking about Mr. Eichmann. Is it just me? It almost seemed like Eichmann was given more favorable treatment than George Jackson. Maybe that's just me. Folks can respond. But he says Eichmann was, by most accounts, a fairly reasonable man. And at his trial, he maintained that it was unfair and gratuitously vindictive to punish him since he was merely doing his job. It was not his idea to send people to the gas chamber. And in fact, it is fairly clear that he was not the sort of man who naturally thinks of such things. Eichmann merely had extraordinary administrative abilities that made him an excellent choice to solve certain complicated logistical problems. For example, how to get thousands of people onto trains so that they could be moved to place of extermination. Eichmann himself never visited the place because he felt sure it would make him sick, as indeed it probably would have. Man, this I'm going to go back and double down. This sounds more favorable in how it presents Eichmann than how George Jackson is presented. I've never heard anyone say that George Jackson killed anybody or was responsible for killing anybody. If I missed that, you can let me know. This guy, Eichmann, helped by the author's own account, helped kill a whole lot of people, but we're still to think of him as someone with extraordinary administrative abilities and who would have felt sick if he had to go there. What information did he have other than this guy's testimony, which certainly would have been self-serving? What evidence did he have to conclude that this guy surely would have felt sick if he had visited the site of the ovens where these non-white people were killed, so-called Jews? That, in my another illustration of racism, white supremacy could be, in my opinion, right there, pretty strongly, in my opinion. See, skipping down where he says, let's see. Milgram, Emmy, when you were talking about the experiment, the prisoner experiment, that is Dr. Zabruto. I think that's his name. I might be mispronouncing it, but it's with a Z. Stanley Milgram, Professor Milgram, that he cites in the book, he did an experiment. It was not with prisoners. It was set up in a laboratory, and he would tell, they would have one person who was an actor. He would pretend to get shocked, and they would have another person. He would be a subject. He would be the person that's being tricked in the experiment. They would tell him, okay, you're going to ask this person questions. If he gets them wrong, you shock the person. And he would, of course, get all the questions wrong. And so they would keep administering these shocks. And he's referenced Milgram's study a few times throughout the book as an example of how if you put people in a certain environment, they will respond and just use words accordingly and just go along with whatever the plan is if you put them in that environment. I just keep pointing out that they have since written, there's been a whole book published that Milgram lied, which is pretty standard with whites. We talked about that a lot with medical apartheid, white people lying about their data and what have you. But Stanley Milgram lied. They cherry-picked that data. Many people did not administer these shocks, that they had to lie to make it seem like lots of people did go ahead and follow this and administer these shocks. But that is not the case. Book, I think it came out in 2015. The author, I believe, is Australian, and she did an interview on NPR. I took lots of notes. Let's see. I thought he did a lot of explaining for the folks in the Nixon administration who were carrying out the Black Identity Extremist campaign of the 1960s and 70s, their COINTELPRO campaign, of which George Jackson was a victim, amongst many others, covering this up to say that these were devoted men who surrounded Richard Nixon, were just doing their job. And a difficult one at that. Covering up crimes is hard enough to do without the added burden of deciding whether to do it. The obliviousness to responsibility for consequences is Eichmannism. I totally reject that. And in my view, that is just white people practicing racism. They find some way of absolving white people of responsibility, culpability, guilt. They were just doing their jobs. This wasn't about people being evil. And particularly when you don't mention, well, exactly what was it that they were doing? Let's go into detail about, because COINTELPRO would be a big part of this. What exactly are these devoted men doing? In my view, could be another act of racism, white supremacy. Let's see. Definition tyranny. I thought that was great. That's one of the reasons on this program consistently. This is my definition of racism, white supremacy, and why I encourage folks to ask, what is your definition, or what does the person mean when they use a particular definition, just to constantly be vigilant of that so that you do not fall, become a victim of this. Many different people have many different definitions. It's not always, people don't always, you know, agree or accept the same definition for a particular concept. I thought these were great questions to ask at the end when you are accepting someone else's definition for a situation. Who or what is the source of the definition? What is the source of its higher authority, his or her higher authority, political power, economic power, legal power, tradition? All of these great questions in terms of when you're going to accept someone else's definition for anything, for racism, white supremacy, or any other term. To what extent have you participated in granting this authority? You know, for to be able to define a word for you, to what extent do you regard the method by which it was granted to be rational, just, moral? What attitudes toward yourself and others are promoted by this definition? Really important to think about. I don't think that's something that we often think in terms of when people sit down to fashion terms and definitions. How do these terms and definitions, how do they reflect non-white people? How do they reflect Black people and how we should think of them when we're using this term? I don't think we often consider that. Yeah, I can think I can stop there. Oh, the sloganeering chapter. Let's see. I'll stop here, but I did have thoughts on all power to the people in the sloganeering chapter as well, but I'll stop there. Did other folks have commentary that they wanted to show? Any of the folks that have a hand up? Everyone satisfied? No additional comments? I'll get my... Oh, go ahead.
I had one other thing I wanted to mention. It was a word that he used. I doubt if I'd be able to locate it, but it was referring to cathartic. And if you look it up, it's... sort of a purification or some epiphany that they have. And I was just wondering if that's what these anti-racists are professing to have happened to them, the reason why they're willing now, or, you know, to give this impression to other non-whites that they are in the struggle with you, if they are professing to have had some type of episode or something that happened that enlightened them. And I'll mute my line on that.
I'll see if I can find where that was in the book before we go off the air. Really quickly on sloganeering, then I'll double check, see if other folks have commentary. Really appreciated his commentary in the chapter on sloganeering, why I'm not a big, even I say right on, I did get a chuckle in there, but that is certainly, I don't think anyone would say that is, you know, they're going to see Gus out leading a protest chanting right on. But I appreciated a lot of the commentary that he presented in the chapter on sloganeering on page 194, where he says that characteristic of the type of sloganeering I am talking about is it is a form of groupthink. It says, this is what we believe, not this is what I believe, or more precisely, it says, this is what we feel, since most slogans cannot exactly be called beliefs. All power to the people, for example, hardly qualifies as a human thought, or if it does, its meaning as anything but a group marker is hopelessly muddled. Very few sloganeers who have used this expression could possibly want the people to have all the power, since I would guess a majority of people in this country are opposed to the various causes which such a sloganeer usually favors. This is another one where I think some of Mr. Postman's views come through. If he was more flagrant here, if he just said, since at this time the majority of the country, white people, if he had just said that, it would have made this a little clearer, in my opinion, around this statement. Even with that said, and I appreciated the folks' commentary, it made logical sense to me, the folks who were saying that they think it could be an act of racism, him picking out this slogan. I think that's true. And I also think his analysis is true, because that statement is all of the critiques that he had of that statement are accurate. I don't think it's anything that you could say, oh, that's invalid or that's nonsense. It is. I have heard tons of white people say all power to the people. It's not like that's something that is precise. Which people exactly are we talking about, and power to do what? And it was tons of those type of vague, nondescript phrases that were not well-defined, where you can easily get a whole lot of people riled up and yes, we can, and that sort of thing. Absolutely, tons of them, but they do not solve the problem. And with racism, white supremacy specifically, it is very easy, very catchy, very attractive for people to come in and make up slogans that you can go out and stomp around in the mud and shout. That does not solve the problem, nor does that generate the needed understanding of what racism, white supremacy is and how it works. That's, man, the whole time I read this chapter, I was thinking, this is exactly why I've been saying for years, do not call me brother. And he included that as part of the sloganeering, which it is. Just, hey, brother, man, how you doing, brother? Oh, sister, how you doing? And you just fall in line like, oh, yeah, I know how to respond. Right on, brother. Right on, sister. And what does that mean? There were people that were in the COINTELPRO program who were saying, right on, brother. Right on, sister. And then as soon as it's on, oh, yeah, they got about 15 black identity extremists over at the club. Right. What does that mean? Like, these are just words, just understanding that. Like, I really appreciated him saying, like, you cannot be seduced into just saying these things because they are catchy or they sound good or they have a nice rhythm or a lot of people are saying them or it has whatever appeal that it has. You cannot allow that to stop you from thinking clearly about, you know, what exactly are we doing? What's going on here? Particularly if I'm out here shouting, what exactly is happening? What problem is supposed to be solved? Like, really making sure that the logic has not been lost for all of the sloganeering. I'll stop there. Any other comments folks wanted to make sure they get in? Everyone satisfied? No additional comments? If we have listeners, if you heard Wretched of the Earth and Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk, you've been listening. If you have a thought, which book you think is more constructive, has information that you could use or pass along to other victims of racism, let us know. Since it seems folks are at least content for the moment, we will go ahead and get to audio segment number two. This is slightly shorter. We are coming to the end of the book, so this is a little bit shorter. We'll have our one segment, and then once this is done, we'll get in our last few comments for this study session. Context of White Supremacy. This is Neil Postman's Crazy Talk, Stupid Talk, How We Defeat Ourselves by the Way We Talk and What to Do About It. Audio segment number two.
Arguments. Let me say at once that, so far as I can tell, there are nearly as many reasons why people have arguments as there are people who have them. Included among these reasons is that having arguments provides some people with a personality, through which they may become forces to be reckoned with. If you have little else to recommend your notice by other people, You can certainly command their attention by hollering, making accusations, and coming to unshakable conclusions. Then, too, an argument is a resourceful way of giving expression to certain antagonisms that a situation may prohibit from being openly revealed. If, for example, you deeply resent another person because he has more money or social status than you, you may find it profitable, and even agreeable, to argue with him about the state of the union or some other matter on which you and he disagree. If you can win, life is bound to be a bit sweeter. If you lose, well, there's always another argument to be had. There are also people, all of us, who would like to understand some issue but who do not have the time, patience, or background to go into it too deeply. Therefore, when it comes up, rather than concede our weakness, it is not too difficult to create the impression that our knowledge equals our interest by starting an argument. Sometimes, of course, we just don't want to be left out of a conversation, and starting an argument seems as good a way as any of getting into the thick of things. To these reasons, and many others of a similar nature, I will not address myself. A thorough and useful analysis of the psychological motives for arguments is well beyond my knowledge, although I am prepared to argue with certain people that it is not. Instead, I am concerned here with a particular kind of argument, one with the following characteristics. It gets started when you do not really want it to. It has deprived you of learning something you really would like to know about, and it has occurred not because of some deep and hidden feelings, but because of a lack of awareness of how language works. In short, I am saying that people sometimes start shouting at each other, take unrelenting positions, make dogmatic assertions, cite mythical facts, and in general, try to win their conversations not because they need to, in a deep psychological sense, but rather because they have been victimized by some semantic process which they cannot control. The kind of argument I am talking about is one that starts off as an intelligent discussion, but somewhere along the way is transformed into an exchange of stupid talk, which everyone later on regrets. My inquiries have led me to think that there are at least 7 important reasons why such situations develop. The first 3 I have already discussed in varying detail. For example, the first is the problem posed by semantic reflexiveness. I will not say much more about this except to repeat that ignorance of it when it is happening may take us so far from a subject that after 4 or 5 minutes we can no longer locate it. And having lost the subject, we have nothing left to talk about except the manner in which we are talking. A second reason, also discussed, is bypassing. Of this, I will say, again, that the tendency to respond to assertions as if their meanings were self-evident is a frequent cause of the erosion of discussion and inquiry. Even in cases where technical words are largely being employed, it can be a mistake to assume that others mean what you mean by them. And a good way to keep argument at a distance is to raise a level of consciousness how everyone is using certain key words. Some people, to be sure, have no patience with any attempts to clarify meanings. They regard the process as a form of semantic nitpicking. Such a process can be just that when carried to an extreme, but when initiated as a genuine quest rather than as a method of harassing other people, semantic clarification helps to keep everyone's attention on the subject and disputation to a minimum. A third problem, again previously alluded to, although not in great detail, is the tendency for statements to be put in either-or terms. Among the many reasons why such statements generate arguments is that they are apt to commit us to a more dogmatic view than we really wish to hold. The government is, the unions are, Nixon was. Sentences that begin this way place a very heavy burden on the speaker, forcing him or her to defend positions that are usually indefensible. We have been told that it is a sign of an open mind if one can acknowledge that every issue has 2 sides. In my opinion, it is not. It is more likely a sign of an either-or mind. To say that the government, or Nixon, or America, is either this or that grants that there is another side to the issue, but eliminates all other possible sides, or, more precisely, makes it appear as if 2 things could not be true at one and the same time. That America is a racist society is probably true, but it is probably also true that America is not a racist society. It depends on what you want to look at. To impose on yourself, voluntarily, the total defense of one or the other position is to aspire to a high and daring form of stupidity. I would go so far as to say that even the metaphor of sides, as in there are many sides to this issue, is an expression of a kind of either-or thinking. For even if you conceive of an issue as octagonal, there is an implication that for every side there is an opposite, that if this is true, then that cannot be. There are quite a lot of people who know perfectly well that one can find many truths in a situation, especially contradictory ones, but to the extent that they have allowed themselves to talk as if this were not so, they become committed almost against their will to an either-or conception of events. For example, people who habitually use the conventional polarities of political discourse, liberal, conservative, capitalist, communist, free world, unfree world, find it very difficult to escape from a total commitment to one side or another and cannot acknowledge any weaknesses on their side. Discussions become arguments when someone finds himself unable to back off, to modify, to qualify, and to account for. Either or sentences do not encourage such multiple viewpoint thinking. A fourth reason for a rapid descent from discussions to argument is that our language does not have clear structural markers to distinguish between statements of fact and statements of opinion. The sentence, "He is 6 feet tall," and "he is handsome," looks so much alike in their form that it is almost inevitable that we will confuse one with the other at some point in a discussion. Trouble arises for the obvious reason that statements of fact can be verified, whereas opinions cannot. Strictly speaking, you cannot have much of an argument about whether or not someone is 6 feet tall, assuming, of course, that everyone agrees on what 6 feet tall means, and no one is out to get anyone else. There are specific, indisputable ways of determining the answer to everyone's satisfaction, but in the case of "he is handsome," there are no such ways. One can, of course, back up one's opinion with facts, but in the end, an opinion can never be elevated to indisputability. This need not be a cause of anxiety or melancholy. Most people are perfectly willing to accept the contrary opinions of others, and many an intelligent discussion will end on a note of civil disagreement. Civility begins to depart, however, when opinions come disguised as facts. Why do you say he's handsome? Because he is. The best protection against this form of stupid talk is also the simplest. It requires that you merely signal when you are offering an opinion. You may do so by prefacing your remark with, "it seems to me," or "as I see it," or some similar phrase which tells your listener that you are now talking about yourself, not the facts of the case, and that you are well aware of what you are doing. I have found that this procedure rarely fails to keep a conversation from becoming stupid too quickly, and will even diffuse those who are really bent on arguing. There are, however, some problems with its use. One is that it can become tedious if used almost every other sentence. Another is that it can become mechanical, like a twitch or a stammer, and therefore lose its point. I have even come across a case of a man who, upon being asked where he grew up, answered, "It seems to me, Dayton, Ohio." The point is that what I am suggesting is not a semantic trick or gimmick. It is a serious method of reminding oneself, as well as others, that you have moved from one level of abstraction to another, and from one mode of documentation to another. I do not want to convey the impression that it is always easy to know the difference between a fact and an opinion. It is possible to maintain, in a serious vein, that all facts are only opinions, and that none of us can ever say for sure how things are outside our skins. We are, each of us, wrapped up in our protoplasmic containers, and the best we can ever do is to say how things look, to us. Reality, Adelbert Ames once remarked, is a perception located somewhere behind the eyes. Thus, it is not so nonsensical for someone to answer a question about where he grew up with, "it seems to me, Dayton, Ohio." But for our purposes, the distinction between fact and opinion can be made in the following way. A fact is a statement that refers to observable events, or events that at least once were observable, and is susceptible to verification, or at least once was. You will notice that in this definition, a factual statement and a true statement are not synonymous. By factual statement, I mean one that is expressed in a form that permits verification or checking in certain obvious ways, looking, listening, touching, counting, etc., and therefore may turn out in inspection to be false. The statement that there are 523 pages in this book is factual in a sense. It is also false. An opinion, on the other hand, is a bundle of conclusions. The important point is that it cannot be verified or checked in the same way that facts can. In this respect, even the statement, "he is tall," is an opinion, not a fact. Tallness cannot be verified since it is a relative term. What is tall to me may not be tall to you, but 6'3"-ness can be verified in a way that is acceptable to everyone. I am not implying, incidentally, that discussions need to be dominated by factual statements. People's feelings and conclusions provide just as good material for discussion as facts do. I am saying that arguments are likely to develop when there is confusion about what is offered as a fact and what is offered as opinion. A frequent instance of this problem is the confusion between ought statements and is statements. In fact, this confusion comes up so often that I will count it, all by itself, as a fifth cause of argument. The usual way it develops is that someone asks a question designed to find out if something is the case or will be. For instance, I recently heard a woman ask what her chances are of getting employment in a certain field that is male-dominated. The answer she received was that there is no reason why this field or any other should not have a healthy proportion of women. That is an answer, all right, but not to the question asked. The questioner wanted to know what the situation is. She wanted a description. The answerer told her what the situation ought to be. She gave her a prescription. I have noticed that many people do not make this distinction carefully enough. If you tell them, for example, that such and such company does not hire women, they will interpret this to mean that you are in favor of such a policy, that in stating what exists, you have stated what ought to exist. That is the sort of reasoning which leads us to punish the messenger when the message is not to our liking. There is, of course, a small validity in this line of reasoning. In looking at any situation, we are apt to select for special attention those aspects of it that will lend support to our general outlook. In other words, we tend to see what we want to see. As a consequence, people who give us the facts frequently do so with a barely suppressed smile which says, "That's the way it should be, and I am proving to you that that's the way it is." A man who believes, for example, that American society should offer equal employment opportunity to men and women is apt to offer us facts which show that this is, indeed, being done. But this works the opposite way as well. There are people who love to give us facts that will demonstrate that what is happening is all wrong, which, of course, they have been saying all along. In other words, a woman who believes in equality may offer us only those facts which show how far we are from the goal. But granted that there is some connection, sometimes, between what people say is going on and what they want to go on, or what they do not want to go on, it is still necessary to distinguish between description and prescription if stupid talk is to be avoided. A sixth cause of argument is simply lack of specificity. In talking about the unions, or Italians, or Arabs, or blacks, or students, or any other category of people or things, taking on more than we can handle. For every statement I make about students, you can make one that demonstrates the opposite. This is fairly obvious, and most of us have had ample warning, in school and other places, about the dangers of overgeneralizing. I mention it here only because I have observed that the warnings have had almost no effect on anybody. Perhaps that is because we have been told in school not to generalize, which would mean the end of all conversation, discussion, argument, or otherwise. The point is that categories have a way of taking charge in conversations, in curious ways. For example, the statement, "The Italians I work with believe," is not nearly so forceful as "The Italians believe," and in our desire to be as forceful as we can, we will have to choose the latter over the former. But limiting the scope of our statements is one of the best ways I know to avoid an argument. A statement such as, "When I worked at Mayer's in 1970, some of the Italians there believed," will almost always receive more credence than one that has not specified where, when, and which. Finally, it is necessary to include here an important cause of argument, what I judge to be the second most feared sentence in the English language. I will not dispute H. Allen Smith's contention that the first is uh-oh, as where a doctor looks at your x-ray and says uh-oh, but surely right behind it is a simple declarative sentence, I don't know. Perhaps because the penalties for saying it in school are so severe, we have all been conditioned to avoid using it. But I have noticed that almost everyone, physicians, politicians, scholars, garage mechanics, yes, especially mechanics, will shy away from saying, I don't know, even when that is the most reasonable utterance available to them. You can watch television interviews for years and not hear a single I don't know followed by silence. Occasionally you will hear someone say, I don't know, but it is then followed by, but I do think that. In other words, I don't know, but I'll tell you anyway. In any case, I don't know, followed by a silence, is a marvelous device, especially when you don't know, for avoiding stupid talk on all subjects. Contrary to what some people think, it is usually the beginning of intelligent discussions, not the end. Euphemism. I have previously remarked on two words which, in my opinion, have an undeservedly bad reputation: stereotyping and prejudice, i.e. prejudging. To these, I would like to add a third: euphemism. A euphemism is commonly defined as an auspicious or exalted term, like sanitation engineer, that is used in place of a more down-to-earth term, like garbage man. People who are partial to euphemisms stand accused of being phony, or of trying to hide what it is they are really talking about, and there is no doubt that in some situations, the accusation is entirely proper. For example, one of the more detestable euphemisms I have come across in recent years is the term Operation Sunshine, which is the name the U.S. government gave to some experiments it conducted with the hydrogen bomb in the South Pacific. It is obvious that the government, in choosing this name, was trying to expunge the hideous imagery that the bomb evokes, and in doing so committed, as I see it, an immoral act. This sort of process, giving pretty names to essentially ugly realities, is what has given euphemizing such a bad name. And people like George Orwell have done valuable work for all of us in calling attention to how the process works. But there is another side to euphemizing that is worth mentioning, and a few words here in its defense will not be amiss. To begin with, we must keep in mind that things do not have real names, although many people believe they do. A garbage man is not really a garbage man, any more than he really is a sanitation engineer. And a pig is not called a pig because it is so dirty, nor a shrimp because it is so small. These are things, and then there are the names of things. And it is considered a fundamental error in all branches of semantics to assume that a name and a thing are one and the same. It is true, of course, that a name is usually so firmly associated with the thing it denotes that it is extremely difficult to separate one from the other. That is why, for example, advertising is so effective. Perfumes are not given names like Bronx Odor, and an automobile will never be called the Lumbering Elephant. Shakespeare was only half right in saying that a rose by any other name would smell as sweet. What we call things affects how we perceive them. It is not only harder to sell someone a horse mackerel sandwich than a tuna fish sandwich, but even though they are the same thing, we are likely to enjoy the taste of the tuna more than that of the horse mackerel. It would appear that human beings almost naturally come to identify names with things, which is one of our fascinating illusions. But there is some substance to this illusion, for if you will change the names of things, you change how people will regard them, and that is as good as changing the nature of the thing itself. Now, all sorts of scoundrels know this perfectly well and can make us love anything by getting us to transfer the charm of a name to whatever worthless thing they are promoting. But, at the same time, and in the same vein, euphemizing is a perfectly intelligent method of generating new and useful ways of perceiving things. The man who wants us to call him a sanitation engineer instead of a garbage man is hoping that we will treat him with more respect than we presently do. He wants us to see that he is of some importance to our society. His euphemism is laughable only if we think he is not deserving of such notice or respect. A teacher who prefers us to use the term culturally different children instead of slum children is euphemizing, all right, but is doing it to encourage us to see aspects of a situation that might otherwise not be attended to. The point I am making is that there is nothing in the process of euphemizing itself that is contemptible. Euphemizing is contemptible when a name makes us see something that is not true or diverts our attention from something that is. The hydrogen bomb kills. There is nothing else that it does. And when you experiment with it, you are trying to find out how widely and well it kills. Therefore, to call such an experiment Operation Sunshine is to suggest a purpose for the bomb that simply does not exist. But to call slum children culturally different is something else. It calls attention, for example, to legitimate reasons why such children might feel alienated from what goes on in school. I grant that sometimes such euphemizing does not have the intended effect. It is possible for a teacher to use the term culturally different, but still be controlled by the term slum children, which the teacher may believe is their real name. Old people may be called senior citizens and nothing might change. And lunatic asylums may still be filthy, primitive prisons, though they are called mental institutions. Nonetheless, euphemizing may be regarded as one of the more important intellectual resources for creating new perspectives on a subject. The attempt to rename old people senior citizens was obviously motivated by a desire to give them a political identity, which they not only warrant, but which may yet have important consequences. In fact, the fate of euphemisms is very hard to predict. A new and seemingly silly name may replace an old one, let us say chairperson for chairman, and for years no one will think or act any differently because of it. And then, gradually, as people begin to assume that chairperson is the real and proper name, or senior citizen, or tuna fish, or sanitation engineer, their attitudes begin to shift, and they will approach things in a slightly different frame of mind. There is a danger, of course, in supposing that a new name can change attitudes quickly or always. There must be some authentic tendency or drift in the culture to lend support to the change, or the name will remain incongruous and may even appear ridiculous. To call a teacher a facilitator would be an example. To eliminate the distinctions between boys and girls by calling them children would be another. But to suppose that such changes never amount to anything is to underestimate the power of names. I have been astounded not only by how rapidly the name blacks has replaced Negroes, a kind of euphemizing in reverse, but also by how significantly perceptions and attitudes have shifted as an accompaniment to the change. The key idea here is that euphemisms are a means through which a culture may alter its imagery, and by doing so, subtly change its style, its priorities, and its values. I reject categorically the idea that people who use earthy language are speaking mortally or with more authenticity than people who employ euphemisms. Saying that someone is dead is not to speak more plainly or honestly than saying he has passed away. It is, rather, to suggest a different conception of what the event means. To ask where the shithouse is no more to the point than to ask where the restroom is. But in the difference between the two words, there is exposed a vast difference in one's attitude toward privacy and property. What I am saying is that the process of euphemizing has no moral content. The moral dimensions are supplied by what the words in question express, what they want us to value and to see. A nation that calls experiments with bombs Operation Sunshine is very frightening. On the other hand, a people who call garbage men sanitation engineers can't be all bad.
Confusing levels of abstraction. Many years ago, mathematicians and logicians were confounded by a certain paradox for which their intellectual habits could produce no solutions. The paradox, which had been known about for centuries, is easily stated in the following way. A Cretan says, "All Cretans are liars." If the statement is true, then it is also false, because at least one Cretan, the speaker, has told the truth. We have a proposition, in other words, that is both true and false at the same time, which is terrifying to mathematicians and logicians. Bertrand Russell and Alfred North Whitehead solved this paradox in their great work, published in 1913, Principia Mathematica. They called their solution the theory of logical types, and it also may be easily stated. A class of things must not be considered a member of that class. Or, to quote Russell and Whitehead, whatever involves all of a collection must not be one of that collection. And so, a particular statement by one Cretan about all of the statements made by Cretans is not itself to be considered part of what he is talking about. It is of a different logical type, a different order of things. To confuse them would be like confusing the word finger with the finger itself, so that if I asked you to count the number of fingers on your hand, you would, if you were confused, say 6. 5 fingers plus the name of the class of things. Take to another example. There is no paradox in the statement, never say never, because the first never is not at the same level of abstraction as the second. The first never referring to all statements, the second to a particular one. Now, all of this has made mathematicians and logicians reasonably happy. But what about the rest of us? It does not happen very often, not even on the Isle of Crete, that a Cretan will approach anybody and announce, "All Cretans are liars." And as for fingers, not even a deranged logician will say he has 6 fingers on each hand, 5 plus the class of things. And yet, for all of that, the theory of logical types has some practical implications for reducing our stupid and crazy talk. For one thing, it provides us with a certain awareness of the different types of statements we customarily make. For example, we make statements about things and processes in the world, such as the temperature is now 90 degrees. And we make statements about our reactions to things and processes in the world, such as it is hot. If you think that those two statements are virtually the same, you are on a path that is bound to head to some interesting stupid talk. Whether or not a thermometer registers 90 degrees is an issue that can be settled by anyone who knows how to read a thermometer. But whether or not something is hot depends on who is being heated. To a Laplander, a temperature of 58 degrees may be hot. To a South African, it may be cold. The statement, it is hot or cold, is a statement about what is going on inside one's body. The statement, the temperature is now 90 degrees, or 58 degrees, is a statement about what is going on outside one's body. Alfred Korzybski provided us with 2 terms which are useful in talking about these different types of statements. Extensional statements are those which try to point to observable processes that are occurring outside our skins. Intentional statements are those which point to processes occurring inside our skins. The distinction is by no means trivial. As I mentioned earlier, more than a few arguments and misunderstandings are generated by people who have confused the two types of statements and who, therefore, look in the wrong direction for verification of what they are saying. I can never prove to a Laplander that 58 degrees is cool, but I can prove to him that it is 58 degrees. In other words, there is no paradox in two different people's concluding that the weather is both hot and cold at the same time. As long as they know that each of them is talking about a different reality, their conversation can proceed in a fairly orderly way. In addition to the differing horizontal directions of our statements, inside and outside, there are differing vertical directions of our statements. For example, assuming you and I are talking about some event that has occurred and that we are trying to describe it objectively, we may still differ in the degree of specificity of our sentences. I may say, 2 vehicles collided, and you may say, 2 Chevy Impalas collided. We are both being extensional in our remarks, but you have included more details than I, and, to that extent, come closer to depicting reality. We may say that my level of abstraction is higher than yours. And as a general rule, the higher the level of abstraction, the less able it is to denote the color and texture and uniqueness of specific realities. I do not say, please note, the less true it is. The statement, E equals MC squared, I am told, is about as true as a statement can be, but it is at such a high level of abstraction it leaves out so many details as to be virtually useless to all but a select few who use it for specialized purposes. Einstein himself remarked that the more true mathematics is, the less it has to do with reality. Nowhere can this be seen more clearly than in our attempt to apply statistical statements to real situations. There is, for example, an apocryphal story about a pregnant woman, let us call her Mrs. Green, who went to see her obstetrician in a state of agitation bordering on hysteria. She had read in a magazine that 1 out of every 5 babies born in the world is Chinese. She had already given birth to 4 children and feared that her next would be a victim of the inexorable law of statistics. The point is that the statement, 1 out of every 5 babies in the world is Chinese, is true, but it is at such a high level of abstraction that it bears no relation to the realities of any particular person. It is of a different logical type from any statement made about Mrs. Green's situation and what she, in particular, might expect. Mrs. Green's problem is apocryphal, but her confusion is not. There are plenty of people who worry themselves to death because they have discovered that they are below average in some respect. And there is no shortage of people who falsely assess their own expectations and, indeed, merit because they have determined that they are above average. For example, a person whose IQ score is above average ought not to assume that he or she will have a better chance of understanding a certain situation than a person whose IQ is below average. For one thing, a score on a test is a highly abstract statement in itself. For another, a statement about one's score in relation to 1,000 other scores is a further abstraction, so far removed from one's performance in a particular situation as to be meaningless. The point is that statistical language of even the most rudimentary sort leaves out so many details that it is, almost literally, not about anything. There is nothing personal about it, and therefore it is best to regard it as being of a different logical type from statements about what is actually happening to people. Generalizations about groups of people present a similar problem. It may be true, for example, that Jews, as a class of people, have a higher income than Italians, but it does not follow that Al Schwartz, in particular, earns more than Dominic Alfieri, in particular. One of the roots of what may be called prejudice lies somewhere in our confusion over what may be true in a general sense and what may be true in a particular sense. The theory of logical types, then, is useful in helping us to sort out our different modalities of talk. There are statements about what we observe, and statements about how we feel, and statements about our statements, of which self-reflexiveness is an example, and statements about how we classify things. In a phrase, statements about different orders of reality. It does not always matter, of course, that we be aware of these distinctions. No one is more obnoxious than the fanatical semanticist who insists upon straightening everyone out even though they have no wish to be straightened. But obviously, there are many situations in which people descend into argument, confusion, or despair because they are not aware of the differing types of statements being made. In these cases, knowledge of logical types, level of abstraction, and extensionality to intentionality can be very useful. But there is still another application to all of this that is even more useful. I am referring to our efforts at solving problems. The basic distinction that is required here is between first-order thinking and second-order thinking. I am lifting these terms from a remarkable book, Change, by Paul Watzlawick, John Weakland, and Richard Fish, in which the authors explain, in great detail, how to apply the theory of logical types to the resolution of practical human problems. The difference between first and second order thinking is a difference in the level of abstraction at which we perceive a problem. When we try to solve a problem through first order thinking, we work within a framework of the system, accepting the assumptions on which the system is based. For example, suppose you were given this problem to solve. Here is a number, VI. By the addition of one line, can you make it into a 7? The answer is simple enough, VII. First-order perceptions are entirely adequate for such a problem. But now, suppose you are given the following problem. Here is a number, IX. By the addition of one line, can you make it into a 6? The problem does not yield to first-order thinking. If you try to solve it by rearranging the elements of the system, you will not come up with a solution. But if you go into another level of abstraction, if you step outside the system, so to speak, an answer suggests itself. SIX. People who cannot solve this problem have usually failed for the following reasons. They assume that IX is a Roman numeral, and only a Roman numeral. They assume that the answer must, therefore, be expressed in a Roman numeral, and they assume that a line must be a straight line. In other words, they have framed the problem in a certain way and have tried to solve it by staying within that frame. Second-order thinking means going outside the frame of a problem and drawing on resources not contained in the original frame. There are several different names for second-order thinking. Some have referred to it simply as creative thinking. The authors of Change call it reframing. Edward de Bono calls it lateral thinking, of which he gives the following example. There is, made in Switzerland, a pear brandy in which a whole pear is to be seen within the bottle. How did the pear get into the bottle? The usual guess is that the bottleneck has been closed after the pear has been put into the bottle. Others guessed that the bottom of the bottle was added after the pear was inside. It is always assumed that since the pear is a fully grown pear, that it must have been placed in the bottle as a fully grown pear. In fact, if a tiny branch bearing a bud was inserted through the neck of the bottle, then the pear would actually grow inside the bottle, and there would be no question of how it got inside. Lateral Thinking, page 93 to 94. One must grant that problems about Roman numerals and pears in bottles are not of the type which ordinarily worry people. But the process by which they are solved, going to another level of perception, can be of substantial practical value. For example, in some New York City public schools, the teachers have a great deal of trouble keeping their students inside the classrooms. Students wander through the hallways during class time, sometimes running, fighting, and screaming, which is not only dangerous but also distracting to those inside the classrooms. Now, if you assume that a classroom is the only place where learning can occur, and that those who are not in their classrooms are a problem, you will spend all your energy trying to get the problems to go where the solution is. You will threaten, plead, and even call the police, none of which works very well. But suppose you reframe the problem. Suppose, for example, you say that the issue is not how to get the students into a room, but how to get them learning something. All sorts of possibilities will now become available. In one New York City school, the assistant principal came up with this solution. She announced that the school was instituting a radical educational plan known as the Open Hall Policy. The plan made staying in the halls a legitimate educational activity. A few teachers were made available to talk with students about a variety of subjects, and thus the halls became a classroom. The screaming, running, and fighting stopped, and I have been told on good authority that other principals now visit this school to observe this starting educational innovation. To take another example, in Change, Watzlawick and his associates suggest that people suffering from insomnia will often choose the worst possible path to sleep. They will tell themselves that their problem is to get to sleep. But since sleep must come spontaneously, or it does not come, to work at getting to sleep will defeat its purpose. They recommend a little reverse English. Tell yourself that your problem is to stay awake, and try to do so. Another example, the New York State Thruway Authority faced the problem of an excessive number of speeding violations. They could have, at great expense, hired more troopers to track down the violators. Instead, they raised the speed limit, and thus eliminated much of the problem, with no increase in the accident rate. The point of all this is that a great deal of stupid talk can be eliminated if we get beyond and outside of our own assumptions. We too often become tyrannized by the way we have framed a certain situation. That is, we allow a set of words and sentences to define for us the level of perception at which we will view a matter. But if we change our words, we may change the matter, and therefore the solution.
Context of white supremacy. That will wrap us up for this week. We will pick up next week inflation and mystification, the next chapter, and we will complete the book next Friday. Context of white supremacy. If you have a commentary you would like to share, the number to dial 641-715-3640, the code 564-943-pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Folks who dialed in with a hand up, if you have commentary you would like to share, line should be open. Proceed.
Can I be
heard? Yes, sir, I'll be here. Go ahead.
I'll wait, Mr. Ford.
Oh, mine was real quick. I wanted to comment right quick on the arguments and that how some people, that's the way that they communicate. And so I think the book was saying that, you know, arguments could be one way that a person has a personality. We all know people that create arguments, and everything is an argument. But if you really look at it, you can probably find some common ground and to be able to, if you're not just bypassing to be able to understand what the other person is actually saying, you know, not based upon from where you, how you look at things, but trying to see it from another angle. And I think one of the things that he said was that he given an example that whether America is a racist society is probably true. It's probably also true that America is not a racist society. Some of these examples that he's using is so, I don't know, it's so untrue that why would you even use that? I mean, you can, I guess, see what he's getting at, but then that's just a true statement. America is a racist society. And more than a racist society, it's the entire nation and the people who classify themselves as white are racist. So I'll mute my line. Thanks, Gus.
Yes, sir. Emmy, were you going to comment as well?
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I actually almost think I lost my thought. I was listening to Mr. Ford. The last thing that he said, goodness, it was about, when we conceptualize a problem and being limited by the language that we're talking about the problem. Am I correct, guys? That is what he was saying, right? Because I was totally off base the first time I spoke. Okay. My comment is short. And that I agree. That's one of my one of the bones that I have to pick with so-called entertainment is that it's very limited. What we do is very limited to the experience that we've already had. Like, we just keep redoing that, and we don't. And of course, you know, we don't control the entertainment and all that kind of stuff. So I know there are like independent artists out there who are, you know, conceptualizing things and doing things, but like making films and producing art that is forward thinking or thinking outside of our experience thus far and conceptualizing what we want it to be, what we want to become and what we want the world to look like. And I think that is my point for right now. If there's time later, maybe I'll comment, but I just think that that's very important that not fixating on the way that it is and the language that we have to describe it, but reformulating it so that we can have something different. Thank you.
Appreciate that, Emmy. If other folks have commentary, 641-715-3640, the code 564-943 pound. Press star 6 if you would like to participate. Our narrator, Mel.
Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay. First off, I am so sorry. I definitely plan on getting a better microphone because between transferring and recording and converting, I found out that I actually have a faulty one. It's no excuse. I need to be better at thoroughly reviewing the audio before it airs, but it won't happen again next week. And if anyone's wondering what I'm referencing, because of this little error, because of this, we missed about 5 pages of the section called arguments. It is worth going back to read them because it did mention how when you ask someone a question, they offer you random answers instead of the one that you asked for. To be sure that your question is getting answered, the difference between a prescription and a description, I believe. Wait, no. Well, it is worth going back to read. And he talked about in that section also the common embarrassment of saying, I don't know, instead of giving just a random answer to a question, just saying, I don't know, would be more effective. So that was in the section called arguments. Again, I'm really sorry about that. In the section called euphemizing, about euphemisms, it's just one of those things where it's something I want to think about. But when he talked about African-Americans, he didn't say African-Americans, but he said like Negroes and Blacks, I think, and African-Americans. or maybe not those words, but he was talking about how the name for us changed from, I guess, from one time period to another, and the significance of that, and how I think he said that it somehow elevated our standing or our position, or that after that, not that things became Mary, but that things seemed to have improved as a result of changing that name. Unless I read it wrong, please let me know. If that is what he was saying, I don't know what he's talking about. I mean, I don't really think the name had much to do with it, but I could be wrong. But I do agree with his point that sometimes, I guess, changing the name or the euphemism can be effective. In the section abstraction, so when he's kind of, I guess, applauding being an abstract thinker when it serves a purpose, not when it confuses the situation, but like with the school that had the children learning in the hallways, it reminds me of, I guess, my historical perception of what happened with voting rights after slavery, where Black people were just property until there was suddenly voting to be done. And then I think even the votes kind of were emphasized. It seemed to me to sometimes that the voting was emphasized as something that needed to be protected, not necessarily the Black people. And so it's kind of like they change you from property to human. And I think that's a very interesting level of abstraction. It makes me think that they could change all sorts of things from a non-voting thing to a voting thing or person. And I did want to say I do agree with your earlier point from the first reading section about Eichmann being portrayed better than George Jackson, because there could have just been one additional paragraph that detailed why George Jackson was not just a car thief, because he calls George Jackson a revolutionary, but I actually don't know who George Jackson is, shamefully, and I don't know who Eichmann is. I mean, before hearing both chapters. But now that I've heard both chapters back to back, I actually feel like Eichmann was represented in a more well-rounded fashion based on what Postman wrote. I have scribble notes, so I have to put them together, but that's all I have for now.
Sorting through the scribble notes, I think that's happened to some of the best of us. And I think most people who read this book, maybe not so when it was first published in the 1970s, I think, at that time, George Jackson's name probably was a lot more well-known at the time, probably Mr. Eichmann as well. But certainly at this point, 40 years removed, I think a lot of people that, you know, have read this book probably didn't know who either of those folks are, certainly don't know a whole lot of details. So this might be the first time that they're hearing these names. Like, I mean, just to think about that. And I did make an error. I was a little bit thrown off when we were reading the first chapter because I was trying to double check. George Jackson, although he was not originally placed in greater confinement for murder or anything violent, it was exactly as what was laid out in the book, getaway driver and this other car. It seems like a lot of vehicle shenanigans. But once he was in greater confinement, he was charged for allegedly murdering a prison guard, prison official. They had some raid or riot or what have you. He and another inmate were charged, but he was never convicted. He was killed before they had a trial for all of that. But that notwithstanding, Mr. Jackson, and even with that, fine, put all that on the record. You put that up with Mr. Jackson and the record of Mr. Eichmann in the Nazi Party. It's, I mean, wow. I felt like in reading about Mr. Eichmann, it's the same sort of treatment that white people get on a regular basis. But neither here. We talked about that already. If folks had any other comments they wanted to get in about the second chapter, feel free. I'll get to some of my notes for the second audio segment, excuse me, that we just finished up here. In the first chapter, arguments, where he says, in fact, even before I get to it, this whole chapter, I was immediately reminded of Mr. Fuller. I think the very first time he was a guest on this program, something that he said to keep in mind when discussing racism, that frequently when people get into these discussions, you know, let's exchange views on racism, they don't really want to exchange views. They want to have an argument. They just want to be able to say, you don't know what you're talking about. You're dumb and ignorant, and I win. That's, you know, what they're looking. This is not something where I'm trying to learn more about your perspective, even if I don't change my mind. And, you know, I can share a few thoughts, you know, my own perspective and what have you. Maybe we come to a consensus. Maybe we don't, but we both learn. No, that's not what this is about at all. I think it's important to recognize that also, because I think sometimes when we go into these discussions, we think we're talking to someone where Maybe I agree with some of this person's points, maybe not, but at least we can have a courteous exchange. That's not what they're on at all. They're looking for, you know, let's have a good old slugfest with words and get rude, maybe call each other some names. You know, we can get hostile about it and, you know, really recognize, because I think sometimes you can fall into that when that's not really going to help to solve any problems. Now, explicitly with the text where he says, we have nothing left to talk about except the manner in which we are talking. A second reason also discussed is bypassing of this. I will say again, the tendency to respond to assertions as if their meanings were self-evident is a frequent cause of the erosion of discussion and inquiry. I think that happens often in arguments, particularly dealing with racism, in terms of just not asking enough questions about what's going on, why are we having this discussion to begin with, just making sure, particularly if it seems like things have gotten too contentious and there's a problem or what have you, asking more questions about exactly the nature of what's supposed to be happening and getting, you know, accurate answers to those questions. I thought Mr. Demery Four and the folks who touched on the statement where he said America is a racist society is probably true. But it's probably also true that America is not a racist society. That is nonsense. In fact, I would say that is crazy talk from his book. Whites do this sort of thing all the time. And what it does, in my view, it erodes what do we mean when we say racism. If we're talking about a serious problem, we are not going to have just flagrantly contradictory statements like that. And he's absolutely right. It means, what do we mean when we say racism? What do we mean when we say this is a quote unquote racist society? What definition do we have? If we have an accurate, serious definition, then no, it's not possible. And I would say statements like that, it's been my experience, you do not hear people say that, oh yeah, in the 1930s, Germany was a Nazi society, and it wasn't a Nazi society. They don't give these sort of, it's, you know, just kind of, depends on your perspective type of a thing. I mean, it's kind of only when it begins to come to black people being abused. Well, you know, just it's real subjective. You know, it's hard to six in one hand, half in the other. Isn't that the way I say? I mean, it's this sort of nonsense. Continuing. Let's see the segment on euphemisms. I thought that was important. I do see a lot of that. Using different words, and I thought his point was very important. When we change the way that we describe an object, we do change the way that we think about and relate to that item. Words are extremely important, something to be mindful of. It's why it's not white privilege. It's white supremacy racism. Who gets called a terror? Like, all of that is extremely important. Continuing, when he says about the sanitation worker, garbage man, that euphemism, he says, when this euphemism is laughable only if we think that the sanitation worker is not deserving of such notice or respect. The teacher who prefers us to use the term culturally different children instead of slum children is euphemizing, all right, but is doing it to encourage us to see aspects of a situation that might otherwise not be attended to. I think similar to the sentence that Mel pointed out during the first audio segment, that just kind of given many of the curious illustrations that he's used in the book, that one I just flagged. I'll have to think about it a little more in terms of meaning. Also, a quick side note, I am not one of the folks who prescribe to, I would prefer the term enslaved as opposed to slave. That does not make me feel any better. I appreciate the fact that it is recognizing that this is something that has been done to an individual by racist man, racist woman. I appreciate that. But if I am a slave, which all non-white people are in the system of white supremacy, I am all right being referred to as a slave until that problem has been corrected. I am not interested in trying to gussy that up or make it seem better than what it is, as opposed to we can change the name when my situation has improved. Continuing, because whites are very good at that. They will put a new name on it, even though the conditions haven't changed at all. Call you a sanitation worker, but you still have not got an increase in pay or showers or anything else. Black workers in Tennessee. Let's see. when he got to that portion where he said there must be some authentic tendency or drift in the culture to lend support to the change, or the name will remain incongruous and may even appear ridiculous. To call a teacher a facilitator would be such an example. To eliminate the distinction between boys and girls by calling them child persons would be another. I think we might be closer to that day. I think they're having a greater push to get away from that. In fact, they're taking another concept, saying, hey, that is dichotomous thinking. We got this gender binary. Let's break out of that framework in terms of the way that we think about gender and sex. So we don't want to talk about boys and girls anymore. Yeah, we'll have child persons. Continuing. Man, I'm still thinking about it. The portion where he says, to suppose that such changes never amount to anything is to underestimate the power of names, words. I have been astounded not only by how rapidly the name blacks has replaced Negroes, a kind of euphemizing in reverse, but also by how significantly perceptions and attitudes have shifted as an accompaniment to the change. I wish he had added another paragraph or so to explain what he meant, like, wow. And particularly about euphemizing in reverse. So if I understand him correctly, euphemizing is you take a term that is not one that is of reverence, of any praise, and you replace that with a term that is more exalted, right? So you go from, he's a garbage worker, sanitation worker, right? So that would mean, if I'm understanding Mr. Postman correctly, that he thought of the word Negro as being exalted in some way, and the word black was kind of the ho-hum word of no significance. That, if I'm interpreting, this is a kind of euphemizing in reverse to go from Negroes to blacks. I wish he had added another paragraph to explain. Wowee. What did folks think about that sentence that I just read? The reverse, euphemizing in reverse, going from Negroes to blacks. Did that stand out to anyone or of no significance?
That stood out to me, and I'm glad you mentioned it, because I meant to mention that in reverse. That would mean that it would be negative then to say black rather than Negro, given some significance, I guess, or exalted position to the word Negro. Exactly what I thought. Thanks for mentioning that, Gus.
I didn't know Negro was an exalted term. That is, I'll have to scratch my head on that one. I've never heard or anyone try to move forward and say that they think Negro, there's something praiseworthy about the word Negro. Any other commentary folks want to make sure they get in?
Hello, can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
I just wanted to answer the question. I agree with Mr. Demery Ford's answer about that when he said it, that it was euphemizing reverse, it did seem like black would be a reverting to something. I guess negative is kind of the terminology I want to use, but not quite. Like, it did seem like he was saying it's going back to something. The word colored has not been brought up. I'm probably just historically ignorant, but is colored a big word when he's writing this book or no? About 70s. Is that still in use or no?
I don't think so by then. I don't think people were saying colored by then. I think pretty much by the 60s, I think black, because I mean, you had Stokely Carmichael saying black power in the middle 60s, and Malcolm X, the Nation of Islam, Elijah Muhammad, they had been big advocates of saying black people. And I think a lot of people were still saying Negro. Colored was still being said in the 60s, but I think by the 70s, I think that had started to be replaced. I don't think you were having too many folks, like mainstream publications and that sort of thing, saying colored by the 70s. I think black was the preferred nomenclature by then.
Okay, then. That is interesting. Thank you for that. Also, I agree with your point where he at I guess everyone's point about where he's America's a racist system, but then it's not. And I'm just thinking back to when he said, I need to hear like a convincing debate that there is a system of white supremacy. Like, I would like to hear that. And I'm just thinking I agree with what you originally said, that just seems like an act of white supremacy to be like, I need to be convinced that I don't know what you're talking about. Like, this is in the 70s. This is so weird.
Indeed. From a very well-educated white person, someone who is not poorly informed at all, retired firefighter, did you have commentary, sir? You should be with us also.
Yes, just tuned in a few minutes ago, had a game tonight. I just heard a few things. First thing I heard was about George Jackson. George Jackson was basically acknowledged and made a Black Panther in prison because of his political activities, counter-racist activities while in prison. And he was, his actions were very influential in and around to the greater confinement of non-white people across the country. It actually played a big part in the motivating factors of the non-white Black people during Attica. He was a great influence, although by that time he was already murdered. The word Negro, as far as what I remembered as a child growing up in the 60s, the non-white Black people around me, it was assumed on my behalf that was some sort of improvement. Now, I'm not saying it was, of course, but it seemed to me back during that time that it was some sort of improvement from the word colored as far as describing us. Of course, to me, the most accurate term that who we are is actually as non-white victims of racism and white supremacy. Can't get more razor sharp than that as far as the description of us collectively. But I had a grandmother that insisted upon still using the term color. And it was other non-white Black people in and around her age, primarily from the southern part of this part of the world, that insisted upon still calling themselves color. As you said, Stokely Carmichael, which was his name at the time, was probably the first person to popularize the term Black. But that's all I have to say as far as for what I've gathered in the program so far. Thank you.
Indeed. Would encourage folks, Soledad Brother, you can read George Jackson. He wrote quite a few books, Blood in My Eyes, Soledad Brother, while he was in greater confinement, where he talks about things that were happening during that time period. I think they have some of his, I've read Soledad Brother. He has some of the letters that he wrote to Angela Davis are reprinted in the book. Some of his thoughts on Dr. King, influence that Minister Malcolm had on his experience, things that he was talking to his parents. It seemed that they did not agree with his, decision, his views on racism, white supremacy, and talking about his younger brother, who ultimately was killed as well, talking about his younger brother and how his brother came to understand racism, white supremacy. It's very interesting reading. You can get more details. He even talks about how he ended up being in greater confinement. And I think he was a victim of indeterminate sentencing, meaning that they put you in prison and you could be there for, any amount of time. Who knows?
Yes,
5 years, 10 years, when, as long as we feel like it. I believe that was...
You're exactly right. You're exactly right. It was.
Yep. But that might be another selection for the book club down the road. We could have read that when we read Asada Shakur. That probably would have been a good match. Any other commentary folks want to make sure they get in?
Two very good books. Yeah.
Reading is more important than watching television, for sure. Oh, and they made that movie. I forgot. Not that, you know, you need to go take a movie, because this is not it, like a documentary or anything. But they did make Black August, which is about George Jackson. That is not a documentary. That is not, that should not be the stamp, particularly for somebody who wrote. You can go directly to the source and read what he had to say. You can get his books. But they did make that movie, Black August, which is about George Jackson. That's relatively recent. Came out in like the early late 2000s, like 2009, 2008, I think. If everyone is satisfied, again, we will be wrapping this here book up next Friday. All done. Moving on. Folks want to check out anything. Again, we will start next Friday. Our audio segment will be hearing what Mr. Neil Postman had to say in the 90s, 20 years after this book was published. What did he have to say about O.J. Simpson? We will get that in next week. And this is O.J. Simpson after the acquittal. What did he have to say? So that'll be for next Friday when we wrap everything up. Crazy talk, stupid talk. It has been a hoot. And again, that's what I said. For some people, I know that bothers them where they say, hey, I would prefer not to read Postman or any of these other white authors because I suspect that they are white supremacists and they might have accurate information. I don't particularly feel like digging through every other line where they're going to talk bad about George Jackson and other black people. Totally understood. I do think that you can learn. One, you can learn about racism, white supremacy as you're reading, but you can also pick out some of the constructive information. That's my view. I could be in error. You know, if you're getting constructive info from the book, great. If not, there are other things we can do with our time and energy. Get to it. We'll be here tomorrow. Compensatory call-in. 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. We'll catch up on the news events that have taken place over the last 7 days. It snowed in Seattle today. I was stunned. This is one of the earliest snows on record in Seattle. It was not any major accumulation, but just it snowed. That is crazy. We should be here on Sunday to discuss with John Patash the Black Identity Extremists, particularly in the context of his work on his first book, The FBI's War Against Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders Like George Jackson. Might be interesting to get his thoughts because George Jackson is one of the folks, I believe, on the cover of Mr. Patash's book. If I have it. I don't have it close enough that I can. I do have it close. Let's see. Is George Jackson on the cover of Mr. Patash's first book? Let's see. I don't think I might be in error. I know he is mentioned, but I don't think he has a picture of George Jackson on the cover. Lots of other black people who were assassinated at the time, but we'll be grand to get his thoughts on the Black Identity Extremist report that just came out, and also to kind of get his update on the opioid situation. He is a drug counselor by trade, so we'll be grand to hear his thoughts on that. Oh, he does have previously mentioned Stokely Carmichael on the cover and previously mentioned Asada Shakur on the cover. Anywho, John Patash will be here on Sunday. Looking forward to speaking with him again. And on Monday, Robin Maynard. She is a black female activist in Canada. She just had a book about policing black lives in Canada. I'll be looking forward to speaking with her as well. If you have questions, problems, guest suggestions, if you can't find something in the archives, drop us an email, untiljustice@gmail.com. untiljustice@gmail.com. We will help out if you're having difficulties finding something or just have a question in general. That's it. Thanks, everyone, for tuning in for the broadcast. I hope it was a constructive investment of your Friday evening. Thanks, Mel, for doing a great job with the audio narration. And again, hope the book has been helpful. I will encourage strongly sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. It is the weekend. If you are going to go out and do any frolicking or what have you, be mindful. Racists, they do not pause just because you want to have fun, do a little recreational activity, be codified, even if you're going to do that. And certainly you do not want to be under the influence and have that cause you more problems, unnecessary problems. Given our condition, racists, they have a long record of exploiting, taking advantage of non-white people who cannot make great decisions because we are intoxicated. Be mindful of that. Dr. Welsing, she would strongly recommend Black people, let's preserve our brain computers. Let's stay healthy. Make sure that we can think clearly so that we can produce solutions to the problem. Racist man, racist woman, racist child. Sobriety would be best. And in fact, before I even wrap up, I did think that was a really important point that Postman brought up about sometimes he called it like you have first level thinking and then second level thinking, where you create a whole new paradigm in terms of how you're going to look at and go about trying to solve a problem. The one thought that I did have, though, is in the system of white supremacy that Black people frequently are punished. We are not allowed to think, behave differently. I know that's been the case for me, and I suspect for many, many Black people, trying to think in a new or different way oftentimes can lead to punishment, greater confinement, George Jackson type thing. So just something to think of. I think a lot of times our creative energy gets muffled. So hopefully we can try to resist that as well in dealing with racism, white supremacy, because we are going to need new concepts, not slogans. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other Black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of Black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another Black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cow signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my condition. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.